Chapter 5, Managing Conflict Without Violence. Executive Summary. This component of our global security system comprises the tools and institutions necessary for assuring security and managing conflict nonviolently. Our strategy here seeks a balance between reforming existing institutions and establishing new ones. We acknowledge the weaknesses inherent in the United Nations system, especially its emphasis on collective security and the challenges of overcoming national self-interest. While these are tremendous, essentially deal-breaking obstacles, the UN is currently our primary form of global governance. At the same time, many functions of the UN, especially outside the security decision-making bodies, provide hope. Thus, our strategy carefully considers several reforms to strengthen UN security functions. International law provides another key function in our system. While limited in enforceability within an anarchic nation-state system, international law is an essential nonviolent tool for managing disputes and conflicts. To strengthen international law, we propose a handful of reforms to improve the International Criminal Court, ICC, and the International Court of Justice, ICJ. Explore possibilities for enforcing existing treaties and creating new ones, and recommend the establishment of truth and reconciliation commissions and other alternative justice and peace-building approaches. We also firmly acknowledge the limited functioning of a system comprised of nation-states and identify strategies for greater participation of civil society in the functioning of our security system. Several civilian peacekeeping forces are already serving vital roles in managing conflict in zones of violence around the world. We also consider the potential of Gene Sharp's vision of establishing civilian-based defense forces, or CBD. CBD is a bold, nonviolent alternative that can make invading a country very unappealing. It also supports a cultural shift in thinking about security and would require training all citizens in strategic nonviolent methods of resistance. Finally, we propose a few alternatives to current approaches to global governance and invite future citizens to consider the essential principles and functions that should guide a peaceful world order. 9 Strategic Policy and Action Recommendations. 1. Demand further study of United Nations reforms supporting a paradigm shift from collective to common security. 2. Pursue democratic changes to UN Security Council composition and permanent member veto. 3. Develop better conflict forecasting and management tools. 4. Establish rapid response peacekeeping and peacebuilding teams. 5. Increase UN funding commensurate with current military funding. 6. Strengthen enforceability and increase compliance to international law. 7. Increase the role of global civil society in peace and security decision-making and action. 8. Study, explore feasibility, model, and design large-scale training for civilian-based defense. 9. Explore and model new proposals for humane global governance. The reactionary approaches and established institutions for managing international and civil conflicts have proven to be insufficient and often inadequate. We propose a series of improvements. Shifting to a proactive posture. Dismantling the institutions of the war system and the beliefs and attitudes that underlie it will not be enough. An alternative global security system needs to be constructed. Much of this system is already in place, having evolved over the past 100 years, although either in embryonic form or in great need of strengthening. Some of it exists only in ideas that need to be institutionalized. The existing parts of the system should not be seen as the static end products of a peaceful world, but as elements of dynamic, imperfect processes of human evolution, which leads to an increasingly nonviolent world with more equality for everyone. Only a proactive posture will help strengthen the alternative global security system. Strengthening international institutions and regional alliances. International institutions for managing conflict without violence have been evolving for a long time. A body of very functional international law has been developing for centuries and needs to be further developed to be an effective part of a peace system. In 1899, the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, or World Court, was set up to adjudicate disputes between nation-states. The League of Nations followed in 1920. An association of 58 sovereign states, the League was based on the principle of collective security. That is, if a state committed aggression, the other states would either enact economic sanctions against that state or, as a last resort approach, provide military forces to defeat it. The League did settle some minor disputes and initiated global-level peace-building efforts. The problem was that the member states failed, in the main, to do what they said they would do, and so the aggressions of Japan, Italy, and Germany were not prevented, leading to World War II, the most destructive war in history. It is also noteworthy that the U.S. refused to join. After the Allied victory, the United Nations was set up as a new attempt at collective security. Also, an association of sovereign states, the UN was supposed to resolve disputes, and where that was not feasible, the Security Council could decide to enact sanctions or provide a counter-military force to deal with an aggressor state. To date, sanctions are not without controversy. If badly designed, willingly or unwillingly, they harm innocent people and thus lose legitimacy and support. Those sanctions should be criticized and challenged, so they will be abandoned. At the same time, it is important to recognize how sanctions can be coercive, nonviolent methods to handling disputes and preventing wars. Peace science informs us that sanctions can lead countries to diplomatic negotiations, which in turn contribute to future cooperation. Sanctioning governments convey strength and solidarity through shared condemnation. Sanctions need to be smart and focus on and affect elites only. The UN also greatly expanded the peace-building initiatives begun by the League. However, the UN was hobbled by built-in structural constraints, and the Cold War between the US and the USSR made meaningful cooperation difficult. The two superpowers also set up traditional military alliance systems aimed at one another, NATO and the Warsaw Pact. The regional alliance systems were also established. The European Union has kept a peaceful Europe despite differences. The African Union is keeping the peace between Egypt and Ethiopia. And the Association of Southeast Asian Nations and the Unión de Naciones Sudamericanas are developing potential for its members and would-be members toward peace. While international institutions for managing interstate conflicts are a vital part of a peace system, the problems with both the League and the UN arose in part from a failure to dismantle the war system. They were set up within it and by themselves were unable to control war or arms races. Some analysts believe that the crux of the problem is that these types of institutions are, in the end, associations of sovereign states, each of which has its own agenda and national priorities, and is not opposed to using war to protect its interests. However, there are many ways that the UN, as well as other international institutions, can be constructively reformed to become more effective in keeping the peace, including reforms of the Security Council, the General Assembly, peacekeeping forces and actions, funding, its relationship to non-government organizations, and the addition of new functions. Reform the United Nations. The United Nations was created as a response to World War II to prevent war by negotiation, sanctions, and collective security. The preamble to the Charter provides the overall mission: to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations large and small, and to establish conditions under which justice and respect for the obligations arising from treaties and other sources of international law can be maintained, and to promote social progress and better standards of life and larger freedom. Reforming the United Nations can and needs to take place at different levels. Reform the Charter to more efficiently deal with aggression. The United Nations Charter does not outlaw war, it outlaws aggression. While the Charter does enable the Security Council to take action in response to aggression, it does not provide a blanket justification for interventionism. In fact, nothing in the Charter mandates the UN to take action, and it does require the conflicting parties to first try to settle the dispute themselves by arbitration, and next by action of any regional security system to which they belong. Only then is it up to the UN Security Council, which is often rendered impotent by the veto provision. The UN Charter does not prohibit states from taking their own action in self-defense. Article 51 reads, "Nothing in the present charter shall impair the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a member of the United Nations, until the Security Council has taken measures necessary to maintain international peace and security." Measures taken by members in the exercise of this right of self-defense shall be immediately reported to the Security Council and shall not in any way affect the authority and responsibility of the Security Council under the present charter to take at any time such action as it deems necessary in order to maintain or restore international peace and security. As desirable as it would be to outlaw all forms of warfare, including making war in self-defense, it is hard to see how that can be achieved until a fully developed peace system is in place. However, much progress can be made by changing the charter to require the Security Council to address all causes of violent conflict immediately upon their commencement, by providing a clear course of action to halt hostilities by means of a ceasefire, require mediation at the UN with the aid of regional partners if desired, and, if necessary, refer the dispute to the International Court of Justice. This will require several further reforms as listed below, including dealing with the veto, shifting to nonviolent methods as the primary tools by making use of nonviolent, unarmed civilian peace workers, and providing an adequate and adequately accountable police power to enforce its decisions when needed. It should be added that most wars in recent decades have been illegal under the UN Charter. However, there has been little awareness and no consequences for the fact. Reform the General Assembly. The General Assembly, or GA, is the most democratic of the UN bodies, since it includes all the member states. It is concerned primarily with crucial peace-building programs. Former Security General Kofi Annan suggested that the GA simplify its programs, abandon reliance on consensus, since it results in watered-down resolutions, and adopt a supermajority for decision-making. The GA needs to pay more attention to implementation and compliance with its decisions. It also needs a more efficient committee system and to involve civil society, that is, NGOs, more directly in its work. Another problem with the GA is that each member state has an equal vote, meaning that a tiny nation with 200,000 citizens has as much weight in voting as a large country like China or India. A reform idea gaining popularity is to add to the GA a parliamentary assembly of members elected by the citizens of each country and in which the number of seats allocated to each country would more accurately reflect population and thus be more democratic. Then, any decisions of the GA would have to pass both houses. Such global MPs would also be able to represent the common welfare of humanity in general, rather than being required to follow the dictates of their governments back home as the current state ambassadors are. Reform the Security Council. Article 42 of the Charter gives the Security Council the responsibility for maintaining and restoring the peace. It is the only UN body with binding authority on member states. The Council does not have an armed force to carry out its decisions. Rather, it has binding authority to call on the armed forces of member states. However, the composition and methods of the Security Council are antiquated and only minimally effective in keeping or restoring the peace. The Council is composed of 15 members, 5 of whom are permanent. These are the victorious powers in World War II, U.S., Russia, U.K., France, and China, They are also the members who have veto power. At the time of writing the charter in 1945, they demanded these conditions or would not have permitted the UN to come into being. These permanent five also claim and possess leading seats on the governing bodies of the major committees of the UN, giving them a disproportionate and undemocratic amount of influence. They are also, along with Germany, the major arms dealers of the world. The world has changed dramatically in the intervening decades. The UN has gone from 50 members to 193, and population balances have changed dramatically as well. Further, the way in which Security Council seats are allotted by four regions is also unrepresentative, with Europe and the UK having four seats, while Latin America has only one. Africa is also underrepresented. It is only rarely that a Muslim nation is represented on the council. It is long past time to rectify this situation if the UN wants to command respect in these regions. One proposal is to increase the number of electoral regions to 9, in which each would have one permanent member and each region have two revolving members, to add up to a council of 27 seats, thus more perfectly reflecting national, cultural, and population realities. Also, the nature of the threats to peace and security has changed dramatically. At the time of the founding, the current arrangement might have made sense, given the need for a great power agreement, and that the main threat to peace and security was seen to be armed aggression. While armed aggression and militarism is still an extreme threat, and permanent member the United States, the worst recidivist, great military power is just one threat among many, such as global warming, mass movements of people, global disease threats, the arms trade, and criminality. The Security Council's veto is exercised over four types of decisions: the use of force to maintain or restore the peace, appointments to the Secretary General's position, applications for UN membership, and amending the charter and procedural matters, which can prevent questions from even coming to the floor. Also, in the other bodies, the permanent five tend to exercise a de facto veto. In Council, the veto has been used 265 times, primarily by the U.S. and the former Soviet Union, to block action, often rendering the UN impotent. The veto hamstrings the Security Council. It is profoundly unfair in that it enables the holders to prevent any action against their own violations of the Charter's prohibition on aggression. It is also used as a favor in shielding their clients' states' misdeeds from Security Council action. One proposal is to simply discard the veto. Another is to allow permanent members to cast a veto, but to make three members casting it necessary to block passage of a substantive issue. Procedural issues should not be subject to the veto. Three procedures need to be added. Currently, nothing requires the Security Council to act. At a minimum, the Council should be required to take up all issues that threaten peace and security and decide whether to act on them or not. The duty to decide. Second is the requirement for transparency. The Council should be required to disclose its reasons for deciding or not to take up the issue of a conflict. Further, the Council meets in secret about 98% of the time. At the least, its substantive deliberations need to be transparent. Third, the duty to consult would require the Council to take reasonable measures to consult with nations that would be impacted by its decisions. Provide adequate funding. The UN's regular budget funds the General Assembly, Security Council, Economic and Social Council, the International Court of Justice, and special missions, such as the UN Assistance Mission to Afghanistan. The peacekeeping budget is separate. Member states are assessed for both, rates depending on the gross domestic product. The UN also receives voluntary donations, which are about equal to the revenue from assessed funds. Given its mission, the United Nations is grossly underfunded. The regular two-year budget for 2018 and 2019 is set at $5.4 billion, a 5% reduction from the 2016-2017 budget. And the peacekeeping budget for the fiscal year 2017-2018 is $6.8 billion, the total amounting to less than one-half of 1% of global military expenditures, and less than 1% of U.S. annual military-related expenditures. Several proposals have been advanced to adequately fund the UN, including a tax of a fraction of 1% on international fiscal transactions, which could raise up to $300 billion to be applied primarily to UN development and environmental programs, such as reducing child mortality, fighting epidemic diseases such as Ebola, and countering the negative effects of climate change. Forecasting and managing conflicts early on. Using the Blue Helmets, the UN is already stretched thin to fund 16 peacekeeping missions around the world, putting out or dampening fires that could spread regionally or even globally. While it is, at least in some cases, doing a good job under very difficult conditions, the UN needs to become far more proactive in foreseeing and preventing conflicts where possible, and quickly and nonviolently intervening in conflicts that have ignited in order to put out the fires quickly. For forecasting, maintain a permanent expert agency to monitor potential conflicts around the world and recommend immediate action to the Security Council or the Secretary General, beginning with proactive mediation teams. Maintain a permanent set of mediation experts qualified in language and cultural diversity and the latest techniques of non-adversarial mediation to be dispatched rapidly to states where either international aggression or civil war looks imminent. This has started with the so-called standby team of mediation experts who act as on-call advisors to peace envoys around the world on issues such as mediation strategy, power sharing, constitution-making, human rights, and natural resources. Align early with indigenous nonviolent movements. To date, the UN has shown little understanding of the power that nonviolent movements within countries can exercise to prevent civil conflicts from becoming violent civil wars. At the least, the UN needs to be able to assist these movements by pressuring governments to avoid violent reprisals against them while bringing UN mediation teams to bear. The UN needs to engage with these movements. When engagement with movements is deemed difficult due to concerns about infringing on national sovereignty, the UN can do the following. Reform peacekeeping operations. The current UN peacekeeping operations have major problems, including conflicting rules of engagement, lack of interaction with affected communities, lack of women representation, gender-based violence, and failure to deal with the changing nature of warfare. A UN high-level independent panel of peace operations, chaired by Nobel Peace Laureate José Ramos Horta, recommended four essential shifts to UN peace operations. 1. Primacy of politics. Political solutions must guide all UN peace operations. 2. Responsive operations. Missions should be tailored to context and include the full spectrum of responses. 3. Stronger partnerships. Developing resilient global and local peace and security architectures. And 4. Field-focused and people-centered, a renewed resolve to serve and protect the people. According to Mel Duncan, co-founder of the Nonviolent Peace Force, the panel also recognized that civilians can and do play an important role in the direct protection of civilians. Even after the suggested improvements, the Blue Helmets' peacekeeping operations should be used as a last resort. After mediation and other proactive measures within a more democratically reformed UN structure. Even with those considerations, the greater militarization, partially entailed by so-called robust peacekeeping, may actually put civilians at risk, along with peacekeepers, other UN officials, and independent humanitarian actors, and in some cases also diminish humanitarian space access. To be clear, the operations of UN peacekeeping or civilian protection forces are not what one would consider a military intervention for the sake of peace and security. The fundamental mission of international peacekeeping, policing, or civilian protection authorized by the United Nations or another international body is different from military intervention. A military intervention is the introduction of outside military forces into an existing conflict through the use of arms, airstrikes, and combat troops in order to influence a military outcome and defeat an enemy. It is the use of deadly force on a massive scale. UN peacekeeping, on the other hand, is guided by three basic principles. 1. Consent of the parties. 2. Impartiality. And 3. Non-use of force except in self-defense and defense of the mandate. Despite these principles, civilian protection is being falsely used as a disguise for military interventions with less noble motives. The human costs never justify any form of military intervention, even if long-term improvements are stated. With that in mind, armed peacekeeping operations must be understood as a transitional step toward ultimately relying on more effective, viable, nonviolent alternatives, in particular, unarmed civilian peacekeeping, or UCP. All peacekeeping missions must be approved by the Security Council. The UN's peacekeeping forces, the Blue Helmets, are recruited primarily from the developing nations. Several problems make them less effective than they could be. First, it takes several months to assemble a peacekeeping force, during which time the crisis can escalate dramatically. A standing, rapid reaction force that could intervene in a matter of days would solve this problem. Other problems with the Blue Helmets stem from using national forces and include a disparity of participation, armaments, tactics, command and control, and rules of engagements. Nonviolent civilian-based peacekeeping teams have existed for over 20 years, including the largest, the Nonviolent Peace Force, or NP, headquartered in Brussels. The NP currently has observer status at the UN and participates in discussions of peacekeeping. These organizations, including not only NP but also Peace Brigades International, Christian Peacemaker Teams, and others, can sometimes go where the UN cannot and thus can be effective in particular situations. The UN needs to encourage these activities and help fund them. The UN should cooperate with other INGOs such as International Alert, Search for Common Ground, the Muslim Voice of Peace, the Jewish Voice for Peace, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and many others by enabling their efforts to intervene early on in conflict areas. In addition to funding those efforts through UNICEF or UNHCR, much more can be done in terms of including unarmed civilian peacekeeping, UCP, in mandates and recognizing and promoting the methodologies. International law. International law has no defined area or governing body. It is composed of many laws, rules, and customs governing the relations between different nations, their governments, businesses, and organizations. It includes a piecemeal collection of customs, agreements, treaties, accords, charters such as the United Nations Charter, protocols, tribunals, memorandums, legal precedents of the International Court of Justice, and more. Since there is no governing, enforcing entity, it is a largely voluntary endeavor. It includes both common law and case law. Three main principles govern international law. They are 1. Comity, where two nations share common policy ideas, one will submit to the judicial decisions of the other. 2. Act of state doctrine, based on sovereignty, one state's judicial bodies will not question the policies of another state or interfere with its foreign policy. And 3. The doctrine of sovereign immunity, preventing a state's nationals from being tried in the courts of another state. The chief problem of international law is that, being based on the anarchic principle of national sovereignty, it cannot deal very effectively with the global commons, as the failure to bring concerted action to bear on climate shift demonstrates. While it has become obvious in terms of peace and environmental dangers that we are one people forced to live together on a small, fragile planet, there is no legal entity capable of enacting statutory law. And so we must rely on negotiating ad hoc treaties to deal with problems that are systematic. Given that it is unlikely such an entity will develop in the near future, we need to strengthen the treaty regime. Strengthen the International Court of Justice. The ICJ, or World Court, is the principal judicial body of the United Nations. It adjudicates cases submitted to it by the states and gives advisory opinions on legal matters referred to it by the UN and specialized agencies. 15 judges are elected for 9-year terms by the General Assembly and the Security Council. By signing the charter, states undertake to abide by the decisions of the court. In a submission, both states' parties must agree in advance that the court has jurisdiction if it is to accept their submission. Decisions are only binding if both parties agree in advance to abide by them. If, after this, in the rare event that a state party does not abide by the decision, the issue may be submitted to the Security Council to determine what actions are necessary to bring the state into compliance, potentially running into a Security Council veto. The sources of the law on which the ICJ draws for its deliberations are treaties and conventions, judicial decisions, international custom, and the teachings of international law experts. The court can only make determinations based on existing treaty or customary law, since there is no body of legislative law, there being no world legislature. This makes for torturous decisions. When the General Assembly asked for an advisory opinion on whether the threat or use of nuclear weapons is permitted under any circumstances in international law, the court was unable to find any treaty law that permitted or forbade the threat or use. In the end, all it could do was suggest that customary law required states to continue to negotiate on a ban. Without a body of statutory law passed by a world legislature, the court is limited to existing treaties and customary law, which, by definition, is always behind the times, thus rendering it only mildly effective in some cases and all but useless in others. Once again, the Security Council veto becomes a limit on the effectiveness of the court. In the case of Nicaragua versus the United States, the U.S. had mined Nicaragua's harbors in a clear act of war. The court ruled against the U.S., whereupon the U.S. withdrew from compulsory jurisdiction in 1986. When the matter was referred to the Security Council, the U.S. exercised its veto to avoid penalty. In effect, the 5 permanent members can control the outcomes of the court should it affect them or their allies. The court needs to be independent of the Security Council veto. When a decision needs to be enforced by the Security Council against a member, that member must recuse itself according to the ancient principle of Roman law or natural justice. No one shall be judge in his own case. The court has also been accused of bias. The judges vote not in the pure interests of justice, but in the interests of the states that appointed them. While some of this is probably true, this criticism comes often from states that have lost their cases. Nevertheless, the more the court follows rules of objectivity, the more weight its decisions will carry. Cases involving aggression are usually brought not before the court, but before the Security Council, with all of its limitations. The court needs the power to determine on its own if it has jurisdiction independent of the will of the states, and it then needs prosecutorial authority to bring states to the bar. Strengthen the International Criminal Court. The International Criminal Court, ICC, is a permanent court, created by a treaty, the Rome Statute, which came into force on July 1, 2002, after ratification by 60 nations. As of 2017, the treaty has been signed by 123 nations, the state's parties, although not by India and China. Among the signatories, three states have declared they no longer intend to ratify the treaty: Israel, the Republic of Sudan, and the United States. The court is freestanding and is not part of the UN system, although it operates in partnership with it. The Security Council may refer cases to the court, although the court is under no obligation to investigate them. Its jurisdiction is strictly limited to crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, and crimes of aggression, as these have been strictly defined within the tradition of international law and as they are explicitly set out in the statute. It is a court of the last resort. As a general principle, the ICC may not exercise jurisdiction before a state party has had an opportunity to try the alleged crimes itself and demonstrate capability and genuine willingness to do so. That is, the courts of the state's parties must be functional. The court is complementary to national criminal jurisdiction. If the court determines that it has jurisdiction, that determination may be challenged and any investigation suspended until the challenge is heard and a determination is made. The court may not exercise jurisdiction on the territory of any state not signatory to the Rome Statute. The ICC is composed of four organs: the Presidency, the Office of the Prosecutor, the Registry, and the Judiciary, which is made up of 18 judges in three divisions: pretrial, trial, and appeals. The court has come under several different criticisms. First, it has been accused of unfairly singling out atrocities in Africa while those elsewhere have been ignored. As of 2012, all seven open cases focused on African leaders. The permanent five of the Security Council appear to lean in the direction of this bias. As a principle, the court must be able to demonstrate impartiality. However, two factors mitigate this criticism. One, more African nations are party to the treaty than other nations, and two, the court has in fact pursued criminal allegations in Iraq and Venezuela, which did not lead to prosecutions. A second and related criticism is that the court appears to some to be a function of neocolonialism, as the funding and staffing are imbalanced toward the European Union and Western states. This can be addressed by spreading out the funding and the recruitment of expert staff from other nations. Third, it has been argued that the bar for qualification of judges needs to be higher, requiring expertise in international law and prior trial experience. It is unquestionably desirable that the judges be of the highest caliber possible and have such experience. Whatever obstacles stand in the way of meeting this high standard need to be addressed. Fourth, some argue that the powers of the prosecutor are too broad. It should be pointed out that these were established by the statute and would require amending to be changed. In particular, some have argued that the prosecutor should not have a right to indict persons whose nations are not signatory. However, this appears to be a misunderstanding, as the statute limits indictment to signatories or other nations which have agreed to an indictment even if they are not signatory. Fifth, there is no appeal to a higher court. Note that the pretrial chamber of the court must agree, based on evidence, that an indictment can be made, and a defendant can appeal its finding to the appeals chamber. Such a case was successfully maintained by an accused in 2014 and the case dropped. However, it might be worth considering the creation of an appeals court outside of the ICC. Sixth, there are legitimate complaints about lack of transparency. Many of the court's sessions and proceedings are held in secret. While there may be legitimate reasons for some of this, protection of witnesses among others, the highest degree of transparency possible is required, and the court needs to review its procedures in this regard. Seventh, Some critics have argued that the standards of due process are not up to the highest standards of practice. If this is the case, it must be corrected. 8. Others have argued that the court has achieved too little for the amount of money it has spent, having obtained only one conviction to date. This, however, is an argument for the court's respect for process and its inherently conservative nature. It has clearly not gone on witch hunts for every nasty person in the world, but has shown admirable restraint. It is also a testimony to the difficulty of bringing these prosecutions and assembling evidence, sometimes years after the fact of massacres and other atrocities, especially in a multicultural setting. Finally, the heaviest criticism laid against the court is its very existence as a transnational institution, an implied limitation on unconfined state sovereignty. But so, too, is every treaty, and they are all, including the Rome Statute, entered into voluntarily and for the common good. Ending war cannot be achieved by sovereign states alone. The record of millennia shows nothing but failure in that regard. Transnational judicial institutions are a necessary part of an alternative global security system. Of course, the court must be subject to the same norms which they would advocate for the rest of the global community, that is, transparency, accountability, speedy and due process, and highly qualified personnel. The establishment of the International Criminal Court was a major step forward in the construction of a functioning peace system. It needs to be emphasized that the ICC remains a very new institution, the first iteration of an international community's effort to assure that the world's most egregious criminals do not get away with their mass crimes. Even the United Nations, which is the second iteration of a collective security, is still evolving and still in need of serious reform. Civil society organizations are at the forefront of reform efforts. The Coalition for the International Criminal Courts consists of 2,500 civil society organizations in 150 countries advocating for a fair, effective, and independent ICC and improved access to justice for victims of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. The American Non-Governmental Organizations Coalition for the International Criminal Court is a coalition of non-governmental organizations committed to advocating for full United States support for the International Criminal Court and the earliest possible U.S. ratification of the court's Rome Statute. Encourage compliance with existing treaties. Crucial treaties for controlling war that are now in force are not recognized by a few critical nations. In particular, the Convention on the Prohibition of the Use, Stockpiling, Production, and Transfer of Anti-Personnel Mines and on their Destruction is not recognized by the United States, Russia, and China. The Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court is not recognized by the United States, Sudan, and Israel. Russia has not ratified it. India and China are holdouts, as are a number of other members of the UN. While holdout states argue that the court might be biased against them, the only plausible reason for a nation not becoming a party to the statute is that it reserves the right to commit war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, or aggression, or to determine such acts as not coming under the common definition of such acts. These states must be pressured by global citizens to come to the table and play by the same rules as the rest of humanity. States must also be pressured to comply with human rights laws and with the various Geneva Conventions. The non-complying states, including the U.S., need to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty and reassert the validity of the existing Kellogg-Briand Pact that already outlaws war. The importance of demanding compliance with existing treaties is demonstrated by the brazen lack of compliance by the U.S. regarding the optional protocol to the Convention on the Rights of the Child on the Involvement of Children in Armed Conflict, commonly known as OPAC. Article 3.3 of the treaty requires military recruitment of minors to be carried out with the informed consent of the child's parents or legal guardians. Meanwhile, American high school youth are often required to take the military's entrance exam during school hours without parental knowledge or consent. Mandatory military testing without mom and dad's okay is a violation of the convention. Despite robust propaganda stating otherwise, the American military struggles to fill its ranks, so it feels compelled to resort to deceptive recruiting measures. Data gained from the Pentagon through a Freedom of Information Act request identifies 1,000 American high schools that require students to take the military's enlistment exam. It is strongly encouraged in 11,000 others. The UN's Committee on the Right of the Child called on the U.S. to ensure the voluntary nature of military testing in the high schools in remarks adopted by the committee at its 62nd session in January 2013 regarding the optional protocol on the involvement of children in armed conflict. The committee also expressed alarm that American high school children are being involuntarily placed into the Junior Reserve Officers Training Corps, known as JROTC, program. The committee calls on the U.S. to ensure that families and children are properly informed of the voluntary nature of the JROTC program. In its response to the committee, the U.S. denied the existence of forced military testing in the schools, and it denied the involuntary placement of children into the JROTC program. Create new treaties. The evolving situation will always require the consideration of new treaties, the legal relations between the different parties. Two that should be taken up immediately are, one, control greenhouse gases. New treaties are necessary to deal with global climate shift and its consequences, in particular a treaty governing the emission of all greenhouse gases that include assistance for the developing nations. 2. Pave the way for climate refugees. A related but separate treaty will need to deal with the rights of climate refugees to mitigate both internally and internationally. This applies to the urgency of the ongoing effects of climate change, but also the current refugee crisis emerging from the Middle East and North Africa, where historical and current Western policies contributed immensely to war and violence. As long as war exists, there will be refugees. The United Nations Convention on Refugees legally obligates signatories to take in refugees. This provision requires compliance, but given the overwhelming numbers that will be involved, it needs to include provisions for assistance if major conflicts are to be avoided. This assistance could be part of a global development plan. Establish Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. When interstate or civil war occurs, in spite of the many barriers the alternative global security system throws up, the various mechanisms outlined above will work quickly to bring an end to overt hostilities, restoring order. Following that, paths to reconciliation are necessary to ensure that there is no relapse into direct and indirect violence. The following processes are considered necessary for reconciliation. Uncovering the truth of what happened. Acknowledgement by the offender of harm done. Remorse, expressing an apology to the victims. Forgiveness. Justice in some form. Planning to prevent recurrence. Resuming constructive aspects of the relationship. Rebuilding trust over time. Truth and Reconciliation Commissions are a form of transitional justice that offer an alternative path to prosecutions and counteract cultures of denial. They have been set up in more than 20 countries. Such commissions have already worked in many situations in Ecuador, Canada, the Czech Republic, and most notably in South Africa at the end of the apartheid regime. Such commissions take the place of criminal proceedings and act to begin to restore trust so that genuine peace, rather than a simple cessation of hostilities, can actually commence. Their function is to establish the facts of past wrongdoing by all actors, both the injured and the perpetrators, who may confess in return for clemency, in order to prevent any historical revisionism and to remove any causes for a new outbreak of violence motivated by revenge. The public and official exposure of truth contributes to social and personal healing, engages all of society in national dialogue, examines the ills of society that made abuses possible, and provides a sense of public ownership in the process. The role of global civil society and international NGOs. Civil society usually encompasses people in professional associations, clubs, unions, faith-based organizations, non-governmental organizations or NGOs, clans, and other community groups. Those are mostly found on a local or national level, and together with global civil society networks and campaigns, they form an unprecedented infrastructure to challenge war and militarism. In 1900, there were a handful of global civil institutions, such as the International Postal Union and the Red Cross. Since then, there has been an astonishing rise of international non-governmental organizations devoted to peacebuilding and peacekeeping. There are now thousands of these INGOs, including such organizations as the Nonviolent Peace Force, Greenpeace, Servicio Paz y Justicia, Peace Brigades International, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, Global Network of Women's Peacebuilders, Veterans for Peace, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, the Hague Appeal for Peace, Global Campaign for Peace Education, the International Peace Bureau, Muslim Peacemaker Teams, Jewish Voice for Peace, Oxfam International, Doctors Without Borders, Pace e Bene, Plowshares Fund, APOPO, Citizens for Global Solutions, International Institute on Peace Education, Nuke Watch, the Carter Center, the Conflict Resolution Center International, the Natural Step, Transition Towns, United Nations Association, Rotary International, Women's Action for New Directions, Peace Direct, the American Friends Service Committee, and countless other smaller and less well-known ones, including the Blue Mountain Project or the War Prevention Initiative. The Nobel Peace Committee recognized the importance of global civil society organizations, awarding several of them with the Nobel Peace Prize. We can also look at how individuals like Jody Williams harnessed the power of global citizen diplomacy to help the international community agree on the global ban on landmines, or how a delegation of citizen diplomats is building people-to-people bridges between Russians and Americans amidst heightened international tensions in 2016. These individuals and organizations knit the world together into a pattern of care and concern, opposing war and injustice, and working for peace, justice, and a sustainable economy. These organizations are not only advocates for peace, they work on the ground to successfully mediate, resolve, or transform conflicts and build peace. They are recognized as a global force for good. Many are accredited to the United Nations. Aided by the World Wide Web, they are proof of an emerging conscientiousness of planetary citizenship. Nonviolent intervention, utilizing civilian peacekeeping forces. For over 20 years, trained, nonviolent, and unarmed civilian forces have been invited to intervene in conflicts around the world to provide protection for human rights defenders and peace workers by maintaining a high-profile physical presence accompanying threatened individuals and organizations. Since these organizations are not associated with any government, and since their personnel are drawn from many countries and have no agenda other than creating a safe place where dialogue can occur between conflicting parties, they have a credibility that national governments lack. By being nonviolent and unarmed, They present no physical threat to others and can go where armed peacekeepers might provoke a violent clash. They provide an open space, dialogue with government authorities and armed forces, and create a link between local peace workers and the international community. Initiated in 1981, Peace Brigades International has current projects in Guatemala, Honduras, Mexico, Nepal, and Korea. The Nonviolent Peace Force was founded in 2000 and is headquartered in Brussels. NP has four goals for its work: to create a space for lasting peace, to protect civilians, to develop and promote the theory and practice of unarmed civilian peacekeeping so that it may be adopted as a policy option by decision makers and public institutions, and to build the pool of professionals able to join peace teams through regional activities, training, and maintaining a roster of trained, available people. NP currently has teams in the Philippines, Myanmar, South Sudan, and Syria. For example, the Nonviolent Peace Force currently operates its largest project in civil war South Sudan. Unarmed civilian protectors successfully accompany women collecting firewood in conflict zones where fighting parties use rape as a weapon of war. Three or four unarmed civilian protectors have proven to be 100% successful in preventing those forms of wartime rape. These and other organizations, such as Christian peacemaker teams, provide a model that can be scaled up to take the place of armed peacekeepers and other forms of violent intervention. They are a perfect example of the role that civil society is already playing in keeping the peace. Beyond providing physical protection and participating in dialogue processes, these groups contribute to the very reconstruction of the social fabric in conflict zones. To date, these crucial efforts are under-recognized and underfunded. They need to be fully sanctioned by the UN and other institutions and by international law. These are among the most promising efforts to protect civilians, create space for civil society, and contribute to lasting peace. Create a nonviolent civilian-based defense force. Nonviolent scholar Gene Sharp combed history to find and record hundreds of methods that have been used successfully to thwart opposition. His search led him to the vision of civilian-based defense, or CBD, an alternative system that could serve the security functions supposedly provided by the war system. CBD indicates defense by civilians as distinct from military personnel, using civilian means of struggle as distinct from military and paramilitary means. This is a policy intended to deter and defeat foreign military invasions, occupations, and intentional usurpations. This defense is meant to be waged by the population and its institutions on the basis of advanced preparation, planning, and training. It is a policy in which the whole population and the society's institutions become the fighting forces. Their weaponry consists of a vast variety of forms of psychological, economic, social, and political resistance and counterattack. This policy aims to deter attacks and to defend against them by preparations to make the society unrulable by would-be tyrants and aggressors. The trained population and the society's institutions would be prepared to deny the attackers their objectives and to make consolidation of political control impossible. These aims would be achieved by applying massive and selective non-cooperation and defiance. In addition, where possible, the defending country would aim to create maximum international problems for the attackers and to subvert the reliability of their troops and functionaries. The dilemma faced by all societies since the invention of war, namely to either submit or become a mirror image of the attacking aggressor, is solved by CBD. Becoming as or more warlike than the aggressor is based on the fact that stopping the aggressor requires coercion. CBD deploys a powerful coercive force that does not require military action. In CBD, all cooperation is withdrawn from the invading power. Nothing works. The lights don't come on or the heat. The waste is not picked up. The transit system doesn't work. Courts cease to function. The people don't obey orders. This is what happened in the Kapp-Putsch in Berlin in 1920 when a would-be dictator and his private army tried to take over. The previous government fled, but the citizens of Berlin made governing so impossible that even with overwhelming military power, the takeover collapsed in weeks. All power does not come from the barrel of a gun. In some cases, sabotage against government property would be deemed appropriate. When the French army occupied Germany in the aftermath of World War I, German railway workers disabled engines and tore up tracks to prevent the French from moving troops around to confront large-scale demonstrations. If a French soldier got on a tram, the driver refused to move. Two core realities support CBD. First, that all power comes from below. All government is by consent of the governed, and that consent can always be withdrawn, causing the collapse of a governing elite. Second, if a nation is seen as ungovernable because of a robust CBD force, there's no reason to try to conquer it. A nation defended by military power can be defeated in a war by a superior military power. Countless examples exist. Examples also exist of peoples rising up and defeating ruthless dictatorial governments through nonviolent struggle, beginning with the liberation from an occupying power in India by Gandhi's People Power movement, continuing with the overthrow of the Marcos regime in the Philippines, the Soviet-backed dictatorships in Eastern Europe, and the Arab Spring, to name only a few of the most notable examples. In a CBD, all able adults are trained in methods of resistance. A standing reserve corps of millions is organized, making the nation so strong in its independence that no one would think of trying to conquer it. A CBD system is widely publicized and totally transparent to adversaries. A CBD system would cost a fraction of the amount now spent to fund a military defense system. CBD can provide effective defense within the war system, while it is an essential component of a robust peace system. Certainly, one can argue that nonviolent defense must transcend the nation-state focus as a form of social defense, since the nation-state itself often is an instrument of oppression against physical or cultural existence of peoples. As noted previously, scientifically proven wisdom holds that nonviolent civil resistance is twice as likely to be successful compared to movements that use violence. The contemporary knowledge in theory and practice is what makes longtime nonviolent movement activist and scholar George Lakey hopeful for a strong role of CBD. He states, "If the peace movements of Japan, Israel, and the United States choose to build on a half a century of strategy work and devise a serious alternative to war, they will certainly build in preparation and training and gain the attention of pragmatists in their societies." Proposals for starting over: alternative approaches to humane global governance. Establishing a new security paradigm requires critique and consideration of what exists and what might be. We've gained significant attention to reforming the United Nations, our present and most hopeful form of global governance. However, we must also take into consideration the failures of the UN, many of which stem from inherent problems with collective security as a model for keeping or restoring the peace. This foundation may be too much to overcome, So we must also consider new alternative forms of global governance to serve the critical function of creating and keeping the peace. Inherent problems with collective security. The United Nations is based on the principle of collective security. That is, when a nation threatens or initiates aggression, the other nations will bring to bear preponderant force acting as a deterrent, or as a very early remedy for an invasion by defeating the aggressor on the battlefield. That is, of course, a militarized solution, threatening or carrying out a larger war to deter or prevent a smaller war. The one principal example, the Korean War, was a failure. The war dragged on for years and the border remains heavily militarized. In fact, the war has never been formally terminated. Collective security is simply a tweaking of the existing system of using violence to attempt to counter violence. It actually requires a militarized world so that the world body has armies it can call on. Moreover, while the UN is theoretically based on this system, it is not designed to execute it, since it has no duty to do so in the event of conflicts. It has only an opportunity to act, and that is severely enervated by the Security Council veto. 5 privileged member states can, and very often have, exercise their own national aims rather than agreed to cooperate for the common good. This partially explains why the UN has failed to stop so many wars since its founding. This, along with its other weaknesses, explains why some people think humanity needs to start over with a far more democratic institution that has the power to enact and enforce statutory law and bring about peaceful resolution of conflicts. Richard Falk, an early contributor to the World Order's Model Project, affectionately known as WOMP, argued that the pursuit of humane global governance was a normative project, one that posits an imagined community for the whole of humanity, which overcomes the most problematic aspects of the present world scene. WOMP sought to consider and design new models of world order rooted in 4 fundamental values. 1. Peace. 2. Economic well-being. 3. Social and political justice. And 4. Environmental sustainability. These world order values identify the purposes and functions of global governance and serve as the criteria from which to assess alternative approaches. Falk suggested that this normative project has 10 dimensions, many of which we have taken up in our outline of a global security system. The 10 Dimensions of the Normative Project by Humane Governance. 1. Taming war. 2. Abolishing war. 3. Making individuals accountable. 4. Collective security. 5. Rule of law. 6. Nonviolent revolutionary politics. 7. Human rights. 8. Stewardship of nature. 9. Positive citizenship. 10. Cosmopolitan democracy. World Beyond War and other networks have developed visions and frameworks for global governance that address many of these dimensions. The Earth Federation and World Beyond War's draft proposal for a global emergency assembly are introduced below. The Earth Federation and the Earth Constitution. The World Constitution and Parliament Association, WCPA, founded in 1958, drafted the Constitution for the Federation of Earth that was ratified in 1977 at the World Constituent Assembly and amended in 1991. WCPA has since been advocating for its ratification around the world. The following is the preamble to the Earth Constitution. The principle of unity in diversity is the basis for a new age when war shall be outlawed and peace prevail, when the Earth's total resources shall be equitably used for human welfare, and when basic human rights and responsibilities shall be shared by all without discrimination. The following 6 points of Article 1 of the Earth Constitution outline the broad functions of the Federation of Earth. 1. To prevent war, secure disarmament, and resolve territorial and other disputes which endanger peace and human rights. 2. To protect universal human rights, including life, liberty, security, democracy, and equal opportunities in life. 3. To obtain for all people on Earth the conditions required for equitable economic and social development and for diminishing social differences. 4. To regulate world trade, communications, transportation, currency, standards, use of world resources, and other global and international processes. 5. To protect the environment and the ecological fabric of life from all sources of damage, and to control technological innovations whose effects transcend national boundaries, for the purpose of keeping Earth a safe, healthy, and happy home for humanity. 6. To devise and implement solutions to all problems which are beyond the capacity of national governments, or which are now or may become of global or international concern or consequence. Article 2 describes the basic structure, positing that the Federation of Earth shall be universal of all nations and peoples, be non-military and democratic in structure, with authority limited to problems and affairs which transcend national boundaries, leaving to national governments jurisdiction over the internal affairs of the respective nations, but consistent with the authority of the world government to protect universal human rights as defined in this world constitution. The Constitution is rich in detail, describing specific organs, powers, and means of enforcement. A world parliament functioning as a legislative body is comprised of three houses: a House of Peoples, with 1,000 electoral districts representing all people everywhere; a House of Nations, preserving the identity and integrity of each nation; and a House of Counselors, 200 representatives from around the world representing the whole of the planet. The parliament is supported by four main agencies. The World Executive, run by 5 elected persons, one from each continent, with no military power and no power to suspend the Constitution. The World Executive, with the help of World Civil Service, runs the integrative complex, which is dedicated to coordinating all agencies of the government. And the World Administration, which are departments necessary to deal with all world affairs as determined by the World Parliament. The World Judiciary is a world supreme court system with universal jurisdiction and 8 specialized benches. The enforcement system with world police and attorneys general, run by 5 heads drawn from each continental division, who enforce world law using only weapons necessary to apprehend individuals. And the last one, the World Ombudsman, is run by 5 heads drawn from each continental division. It's an entire worldwide agency dedicated to protecting and promoting human rights everywhere on Earth. Proposal for a Global Emergency Assembly. Another framework for global governance is World Beyond War's vision for a Global Emergency Assembly, or GEA. Although a work in progress, we share a short summary of it here along with the proposals above in hopes of stimulating much-needed alternative thinking on approaches to global governance. GEA is intended to replace the United Nations and related institutions. The design of GEA balances representation of nations with representation of people, also engaging with local and provincial governments that tend to be more representative than national ones. The Global Emergency Assembly does not, in its structure, favor any existing government over any other or create laws that impact other governments, businesses, or individuals beyond what is necessary to prevent global catastrophe. GEA consists of two representative bodies, an educational scientific cultural organization, and several smaller committees. The People's Assembly, PA, consists of 5,000 members, each of whom represents the population of a coherent geographic area with a near-equivalent population of voters. PA members are elected with maximum participation, fairness, transparency, choice, and verifiability. The Nations Assembly, NA, consists of approximately 200 members, each of whom represents a national government. Members serve two-year terms with elections or appointments in even-numbered years. NA members are elected or appointed by national publics, government bodies, or rulers, as each nation determines. A democratic global institution without a military or the power to mobilize militaries should not threaten national interests, but rather allow nations the means to circumvent their own weaknesses. Governments that choose not to join will be left out of global decision-making. National governments will not be permitted to join the NA unless their people and regional and local governments have complete freedom to participate in and fund the PA. The GEA Educational Scientific and Cultural Organization, GESCO, is overseen by a 5-member board serving staggered 10-year terms and elected by the two assemblies, which also retain the power to remove and replace GESCO board members. Members of both assemblies and of GESCO are required to obtain training in nonviolent communication, conflict resolution, and dialogue deliberation methods for the common good. The assemblies identify global and common issues and problems to be addressed. Examples might be war, environmental destruction, starvation, disease, population growth, and mass homelessness. GESCO makes recommendations for each project and also identifies areas of the world that are having the most success in working on each project. Assembly members from those areas of the world will have the first option of joining the relevant committees. Committees of 45, including 30 PA members and 15 NA members, pursue GEA's work on particular projects. GESCO is also tasked with organizing an annual competition for development of the best educational, scientific, or cultural creations in the area of each project. GEA maintains 5 meeting locations around the world, rotating assembly meetings among them, and allowing committees to meet in multiple locations connected by video and audio. Both assemblies make decisions by public, recorded majority vote, and together they have the power to create or dissolve committees and to delegate work to those committees. GEA's resources come from payments made by local and regional, but not national, governments. These payments are required in order for the residents of any jurisdiction to participate and are determined on the basis of ability to pay. GEA seeks compliance with global laws and participation in global projects on the part of governments at every level, as well as businesses and individuals. In doing so, it is bound by its constitution to forego the use of violence, the threat of violence, the sanctioning of violence, or any complicity in the preparations for the use of violence. The same constitution requires respecting the rights of future generations, of children, and of the natural environment. Tools for creating compliance include moral pressure, praise, and condemnation. Positions on committees for those areas of the world performing the best on the relevant work. Rewards in the form of investments. Punishment in the form of leading and organizing divestments and boycotts. The practice of restorative justice in arbitration hearings and prosecutions, the creation of truth and reconciliation commissions, and the ultimate sanction of banishment from representation in GEA. Many of these tools are implemented by a GEA court, whose panels of judges are elected by the GEA assemblies. Chapter 6, Creating a Culture of Peace. Executive Summary. Article 2 of the UN Declaration and Program of Action on a Culture of Peace observes that progress in the fuller development of a culture of peace comes about through values, attitudes, modes of behavior, and ways of life conducive to the promotion of peace among individuals, groups, and nations. These are the essential elements pursued by this component of our system. A culture of peace also helps us to establish the vision and guiding principles of the world we prefer and desire. In our engaged activism, it is easy to direct our energy almost entirely toward resistance to that which we oppose. This is done at the expense of reflecting on and designing the alternatives. Frameworks previously explored, including common security, human security, ecological security, and nonviolence, comprise the ethical and normative criteria for assessing the alternative approaches and strategies described throughout this book. In this section, we begin to identify and tell the new story and peaceful evolutions that have been emerging. These positive trends give us hope and inspiration that peaceful change is indeed possible. Educational efforts supporting planetary citizenship establish a foundation of interconnection and interdependence on our shared planet. Formal and non-formal peace education and peace research are primary tools for writing the software of our peace system. In this section, we also introduce and advocate for responsible peace journalism, a proactive approach to news reporting that emphasizes illuminating the underlying causes of conflict, frames conflicts in terms of their complexity, and seeks to publicize peace initiatives commonly ignored by the mainstream press. Finally, we examine the role and potential of religion as a tool for peacebuilding, rather than a cause of violence. Strategic Policy and Action Recommendations. Encourage adoption of local, state, and national plans of action supporting the achievement of the principles of the UN Declaration and Program of Action on a Culture of Peace. Support the development of curricula encouraging understanding of planetary citizenship. Provide increased funding for peace research. Advocate for the universalization of peace education into all formal and non-formal settings and teacher training institutions. Support responsible media outlets that promote peace journalism. Get the word out on the new story that is emerging. Encourage religiously motivated peacemaking and peacebuilding. Many of the approaches outlined here address what Thomas Merton called the climate of thought, the current values and frameworks that normalize violence in a society. Elise Boulding, a founding figure of peace and conflict studies, wrote, "Put in the simplest possible terms, a peace culture is a culture that promotes peaceable diversity. Such a culture includes lifeways, patterns of belief, values, behavior, and accompanying institutional arrangements that promote mutual caring and well-being, as well as an equality that includes appreciations of difference, stewardship, and equitable sharing of the resources. It offers mutual security for humankind in all its diversity through a profound sense of species identity, as well as kinship with the living earth. There is no need for violence." A culture of peace is contrasted with a warrior culture, also known as a dominator society, where warrior gods instruct the people to create hierarchies of rank so that men dominate other men, men dominate women. There is a constant competition and frequent physical violence, and nature is seen as something to be conquered. In a warrior culture, safety is only for those individuals or nations that are at the top, if they can stay there. No society is completely one or the other, but in today's world, the tilt is toward the warrior societies, making necessary the growth of a culture of peace if humanity is to survive. Societies that socialize their children for aggressive behavior make wars more likely, and in a vicious circle, wars socialize people for aggression. In 1999, the United Nations General Assembly approved a Program of Action on a Culture of Peace. Article 1 further defines it. A culture of peace is a set of values, attitudes, traditions, and modes of behavior and ways of life based on 1. Respect for life, ending of violence and promotion of practice of nonviolence through education, dialogue, and cooperation. 2. Full respect for the principles of sovereignty, territorial integrity, and political independence of states, and non-intervention in matters which are essentially within the domestic jurisdiction of any state, in accordance with the Charter of the United Nations and international law. 3. Full respect for and promotion of all human rights and fundamental freedoms. 4. Commitment to peaceful settlement of conflicts. 5. Efforts to meet the developmental and environmental needs of present and future generations. 6. Respect for and promotion of the right to development. 7. Respect for and promotion of equal rights and opportunities for women and men. 8. Respect for and promotion of the right of everyone to freedom of expression, opinion, and information. 9. Adherence to the principles of freedom, justice, democracy, tolerance, solidarity, cooperation, pluralism, cultural diversity, dialogue and understanding at all levels of society and among nations, fostered by an enabling of such adherence. The General Assembly identified 8 action areas. 1. Fostering a culture of peace through education. 2. Promoting sustainable economic and social development. 3. Promoting respect for all human rights. 4. Ensuring equality between women and men. 5. Fostering democratic participation. 6. Advancing understanding, tolerance, and solidarity. 7. Supporting participatory communication and the free flow of information and knowledge. 8. Promoting international peace and security. The Global Movement for the Culture of Peace is a partnership of groups from civil society that have banded together to promote a culture of peace. Part of the work is to tell a new story. Telling a new story. Crucial to further developing a culture of peace is the telling of a new story about humanity and the earth. The old story, beloved by governments and too many journalists and teachers, is that the world is a dangerous place, that war has always been with us, is inevitable, in our genes, is good for the economy, that preparing for war ensures peace, that it's impossible to end war, that the global economy is a dog-eat-dog competition, and if you don't win, you lose. That resources are scarce, and if you want to live well, you must grab them, often by force, and that nature is simply a mine of raw materials. This story is a fatalistic, self-fulfilling, deterministic outlook that claims to be realism, but is in fact defeatist pessimism. In the old story, history is presented as little more than a succession of wars. As peace educator Darren Riley puts it, the assumption that war is a natural and necessary force of human progress is deeply ingrained and continues to be reinforced by the way we teach history. In the U.S., the content standards for teaching American history go like this. Cause and consequences of the American Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, the Civil War, World War I, the Great Depression and how World War II ended it, civil rights, war, war, war. Taught this way, war becomes the unquestioned driver of social change. But it is an assumption that needs to be challenged, or students will take it for truth. All the cooperative endeavors of humanity, the long periods of peace, the existence of peaceful societies, the development of conflict resolution skills, and the remarkable stories of successful nonviolence are all ignored in the traditional recounting of the past that can only be described as warist. Fortunately, historians from the Council on Peace Research in History and others have begun revising this view bringing the light to reality of peace in our history. There is a new story, backed up by science and experience. In fact, war is a relatively recent social invention. We humans have been around for over 100,000 years, but there is little evidence of warfare, and certainly interstate warfare, going back much more than 6,000 years. Very few known earlier instances of warlike activities dating back 10,000 years, and none earlier. For 95% of our history, we were without war, indicating that war is not genetic, but cultural. Even during the worst period of wars we have seen, in the 20th century, there was far more interstate peace in the human community than war. For example, the U.S. fought Germany for 6 years, but was at peace with her for 94. With Australia for over 100 years, with Canada for well over that, and never at war with Brazil, Norway, France, Poland, and Burma. Most people live at peace most of the time. Michael Nagler of the Meta Center for Nonviolence suggests that we are living in the midst of a developing global peace system. The old story defined the human experience in terms of materialism, greed, and violence in a world where individuals and groups are alienated from one another and from nature. The new story is a story of belonging and of cooperative relationships. Some have called it the story of developing partnership society. It is a story of an emerging realization that we are a single species, humanity, living in a generous web of life that provides all we need for life. We are partnered with one another and with the earth for life. What enriches life is not mere material goods, although a minimum is surely necessary, but rather meaningful work and relationships based on trust and mutual service. Acting together, we have the power to create our own destiny. We are not doomed to failure. The Meta Center for Nonviolence holds four propositions that help define the new story. Life is an interconnected whole of inestimable worth. We cannot be fulfilled by an indefinite consumption of things, but by a potentially infinite expansion of our relationships. We can never injure others without injuring ourselves. And security does not come from defeating enemies. It can only come from turning enemies into friends. The unprecedented peace revolution of modern times. Surprisingly, if one looks at the last 200 years of history, one sees not only the industrialization of warfare, but also a powerful trend toward a peace system and the development of a culture of peace, a veritable revolution. Beginning with the emergence of citizen-based organizations dedicated to getting rid of war in the early 19th century, some 28 trends are clearly visible leading toward a developing global peace system. These include the emergence of international courts, starting with the International Court of Justice in 1899, the creation of international parliamentary institutions to control war, the League of Nations in 1919 and the UN in 1945, the invention of international peacekeeping forces under the auspices of the UN and other international organizations such as the African Union, deployed in dozens of conflicts around the globe for over 50 years. The invention of nonviolent struggle as a substitute for war, beginning with Gandhi, carried on by King, perfected in the struggles to overthrow the East European Communist Empire, Marcos in the Philippines, and Mubarak in Egypt and elsewhere. The invention of new techniques of conflict resolution known as non-adversarial bargaining, mutual gains bargaining, or win-win. The development of peace research and peace education, including the rapid spread of peace research institutions and projects, and peace education in hundreds of colleges and universities around the world, and the peace conference movement. For example, the Wisconsin Institute Annual Student Conference and Annual Fall Conference, the Peace and Justice Studies Association Annual Conference, the International Peace Research Association Biennial Conference, Pugwash Annual Peace Conference, World Beyond War's Annual No War Conference, and many others. In addition to these developments, other advancements towards a culture of peace include a growing body of peace literature, hundreds of books, journals, and thousands of articles, and peace journalism that unpacks war propaganda in the media, the global spread of democracy. It is a fact that democracies tend not to attack one another. The development of large regions of stable peace, especially in Scandinavia, U.S., Canada, Mexico, South America, and now Western Europe, where future war is either unthinkable or highly unlikely. And the decline of racism and apartheid regimes and the end of political colonialism. We are, in fact, witnessing the end of empire. Empire is becoming an impossibility due to asymmetric warfare, nonviolent resistance, and astronomical costs that bankrupt the imperial state. This peace revolution is enabled by the ongoing erosion of national sovereignty due to globalization. Nation states can no longer keep out immigrants, ideas, economic trends, disease organisms, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and information. Further advances include the development of the worldwide women's movement. Education and rights for women have been spreading rapidly in the 20th century. Educating girls is the single most important thing we can do to ensure sound economic development. Further components of the revolution are the rise of the global environmental sustainability movement aimed at slowing and ending excessive consumption of resources and fossil fuels, which exacerbates economic injustice, climate change, and conflicts. The spread of peace-oriented forms of religion, the Christianity of Thomas Merton and Jim Wallace, the Episcopal Peace Fellowship, the Buddhism of the Dalai Lama, the Jewish Peace Fellowship, the Muslim Peace Fellowship, and the Muslim Voice of Peace, and the rise of international civil society from a handful of INGOs in 1900 to tens of thousands today, creating a new non-governmental citizen-based world system of communication and interaction for peace, justice, environmental preservation, sustainable economic development, human rights, disease control, literacy, and clean water. The 20th and 21st centuries have also witnessed the rapid growth of an international law regime to control war, including the Geneva Conventions, the treaties banning landmines and the use of child soldiers, atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons and placing nuclear weapons on the seabed, among others. Further, we've seen the rise of the human rights movement, once totally ignored, now an international norm whose violation is an outrage in most countries and brings immediate response from states and NGOs. Nor is this all. The peace revolution includes the rise of the global conference movement, such as the Earth Summit in 1992 in Rio, attended by 100 heads of states, 10,000 journalists, and 30,000 citizens. Since then, global conferences on economic development, women, peace, global warming, and other topics have been held, creating a new forum for people from all over the world to come together to confront problems and create cooperative solutions. Globally, we have also witnessed the further evolution of a system of diplomacy with well-established norms of diplomatic immunity, third-party good offices, and permanent missions, all designed to allow states to communicate even in conflict situations. The development of global interactive communication via the World Wide Web and cell phones has fostered all of these advancements by providing the means for ideas about democracy, peace, environment, and human rights to spread almost instantly. Perhaps most important is a global shift in attitudes about war, a sharp decline over the past 100 years of the old attitude that war is glorious and noble enterprise. A special part of this new story is spreading information about the record of successful nonviolent methods of peace and justice making. The emergence of this embryonic global peace system is part of the larger development of a culture of peace. Planetary Citizenship. One People, One Planet, One Peace. Humans constitute a single species, Homo sapiens. While we have developed a marvelous diversity of ethnic, religious, economic, and political systems which enrich our common life, we are, in fact, one people, living on a very fragile planet. The biosphere, which supports our lives and our civilizations, is extremely thin, like the skin of an apple. Within it is everything we all need to stay alive and well. We all share one atmosphere, one great ocean, one global climate, one single source of fresh water endlessly cycled around the Earth, one great biodiversity. These constitute the biophysical commons on which civilization rests. It is gravely threatened by our industrial way of life, and our common task is to preserve it from destruction if we wish to live on. Today, the single most important responsibility of national governments and governing agreements at the international level is the protection of the commons. Former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon saw the importance of this, framed as global citizenship, and made it a cornerstone of his Global Education First Initiative, or GEFI. Global citizenship education is also a strategic pillar of the work of UNESCO. We need to think first of the health of the global commons and only second in terms of national interests, for the latter is now totally dependent on the former. The commons also includes the social commons, which is the condition of just peace. All must be safe, if any are to be safe. The safety of any must guarantee the safety of all. A just peace is a society in which there is no fear of violent attack, war or civil war, of exploitation of one group by another, no political tyranny, where everyone's basic needs are met, and where all have the right to participate in the decisions that impact them. Just as a healthy biophysical commons requires biological diversity, a healthy social commons requires social diversity. Protecting the commons is best achieved by voluntary consensus, so that it is a self-organizing process from below, a function of shared values and mutual respect that arise out of a sense of responsibility for the planet's well-being. When consensus is not available, when some individuals, corporations, or nations do not care about the common good, when they want to make war or degrade the environment for gain, then government is needed to protect the commons, and that means laws, courts, and the police power necessary to enforce them. We have reached a stage in human and evolutionary history where the protection of the commons is necessary not only for providing a good life for humanity, but to our very survival. This means new ideas, especially the realization that we are a single planetary community. It also includes creating new associations, new forms of democratic governance, and new agreements between nations to protect the commons. War not only distracts us from this vital task, but it adds to the destruction. We will never end conflict on the planet, but conflict does not have to lead to war. We are a highly intelligent species who have already developed nonviolent methods of conflict resolution, which can, and in some cases are, taking the place of violent means. We need to scale these up until we provide for common security, a world where all the children are safe and healthy, free from fear, want, and persecution, a successful human civilization resting on a healthy biosphere. One people, one planet, one peace is the essential of the new story we need to tell. It is the next stage in the progress of civilization. In order to grow and spread the culture of peace, we need to reinforce several already ongoing trends. Spreading and funding peace education and peace research. For millennia, we educated ourselves about war, focusing our best minds on how to win it. Just as narrow-minded historians had insisted there was no such thing as black history or women's history, so too they argued there was no such thing as the history of peace. Humanity had failed to focus on peace until the new fields of peace research and peace education developed in the wake of the catastrophe that was World War II, and accelerated in the 1980s after the world came close to nuclear annihilation. In the years since, there has been a vast increase in information about the conditions of peace. The United States Institute of Peace, USIP, was established by Congress in 1984 as an independent, federally funded national security institution devoted to the nonviolent prevention and mitigation of deadly conflict abroad. It sponsors events, provides education, training, and publications, including a peacemaker's toolkit. Unfortunately, USIP has never been known to oppose U.S. wars. Nonetheless, the existence of USIP and other similar institutions is a step in the right direction of spreading understanding of peaceful alternatives. Formal and non-formal education that supports peace is an essential component of a global security system. Developing and applying knowledge and skills in the methodologies and pedagogies of peace education is also essential to educating the many, facilitating the learning and discourse necessary to challenge assumptions of the war system and foster political efficacy that leads to action for system change. Betty Reardon has long maintained that one of the fundamental purposes of peace education should be the fostering of political efficacy. In essence, it is not enough to teach about peace. We must also teach for peace. Most educational campaigns in the activist world are oriented toward informing citizens about the issues and the actions they might take. While informing is essential to our task of abolishing war, we must also add to our toolkit transformative learning strategies that support worldview consideration and the internalization of values and motivations that lead to external action. Beyond formal education, many of us engage in non-formal peace education with adults who have deeply rooted world views and a generally unhealthy level of pessimism about the possibilities for abolishing war. In these circumstances, it's helpful to consider some very basic practices that might be integrated into our learning strategies. The most fundamental of transformative learning process is reflection. Reflection is essential to our growth as human beings. To challenge assumptions, internalize values and principles, and to improve our practice as activists and peace builders. As activists, we rarely afford ourselves the time to reflect and learn from our experience. We subscribe to the maxim, "Don't just stand there, do something." Peace researcher Kenneth Boulding flipped this call to action on its head. Don't do something, just stand there. Betty Reardon interpreted this to mean, even in times of crisis, reflection is a fundamental necessity to intelligent human action. Most important to our work as activists is the need to learn from our experience to improve our practice and develop more effective future actions. Paulo Freire, the Brazilian popular educator and author of Pedagogy of the Oppressed, rooted reflection in a cycle of learning and action he described as praxis. While this praxis can work as a tool to improve our actions, it is also a tool of liberation for the oppressed. We can consider many who subscribe to the view that war is essential, inevitable, or hopelessly unchangeable, to be trapped in the oppressive grip of militarism and the war system. Learning to see the world differently requires reflection, and to become reflective practitioners requires practice. Reflective inquiry is an approach we can use to pose queries and questions to facilitate perspective talking. Engage in critical consideration of systems of power. Consider our ethical positions and morality, and ruminate on possibilities and preferences for the world we prefer and desire. Peace education now embraces all levels of formal education, from kindergarten through doctoral studies. The Global Campaign for Peace Education has been leading efforts to universalize peace education. It builds awareness and political support for the introduction of peace education, including non-formal education in all schools throughout the world, and promotes the education of all teachers to teach for peace. Hundreds of college campuses provide majors, minors, and certificate programs in peace studies and peace education. At the university level, the Peace and Justice Studies Association gathers researchers, teachers, and peace activists for conferences, publishes a journal, the Peace Chronicle, and provides a resource base. Curricula and courses have multiplied and are taught as age-specific instruction at all levels. In addition, a whole new field of literature has developed, including hundreds of books, articles, videos, and films about peace now available to the general public. Cultivating peace journalism. The warist bias we commonly see in the teaching of history also infects mainstream journalism. Too many reporters, columnists, and news anchors are stuck in the old story that war is inevitable and that it brings peace. Moreover, in the media, the expertise related to war and peace provided by members of the intelligentsia is very one-sided. Many of these eloquent individuals have achieved their legitimacy through academic credentials, military authority, or recognition as political commentators. Their facts, opinions, and advice on matters of war and peace shape the dominant discourse and mostly serve to uphold the status quo of a war system. That comes from Give Peace Science a Chance in the Diplomatic Courier. There are, however, new initiatives in peace journalism, a movement conceived by peace scholar Johan Galtung. In peace journalism, editors and writers give the reader a chance to consider nonviolent responses to conflict rather than the usual knee-jerk reaction of counterviolence. Peace journalism focuses on the structural and cultural causes of violence and its impacts on actual people, rather than the abstract analysis of states, and frames conflicts in terms of their real complexity in contrast to war journalism's simple good guys versus bad guys. It also seeks to publicize peace initiatives commonly ignored by the mainstream press. The Center for Global Peace Journalism publishes the Peace Journalist magazine and offers 10 characteristics of peace journalism, or PJ. PJ is proactive, examining the causes of conflict and looking for ways to encourage dialogue before violence occurs. 2. PJ looks to unite parties rather than divide them, and eschews oversimplification, us versus them, and good guy versus bad guy reporting. 3. Peace reporters reject official propaganda and instead seek facts from all sources. 4. PJ is balanced, covering issues, suffering, peace proposals from all sides of a conflict. 5. PJ gives voice to the voiceless, instead of just reporting for and about elites and those in power. 6. Peace journalists provide depth and context rather than just superficial and sensational blow-by-blow accounts of violence and conflict. 7. Peace journalists consider the consequences of their reporting. 8. Peace journalists carefully choose and analyze the words they use, understanding that carelessly selected words are often inflammatory. 9. Peace journalists thoughtfully select the images they use, understanding that they can misrepresent an event, exacerbate an already dire situation, and re-victimize those who have suffered. 10. Peace journalists offer counter-narratives that debunk media-created or perpetuated stereotypes, myths, and misperceptions. The following table, based on Johan Galtung's work, compares the peace journalism framework to the war violence journalism framework. A notable example is Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. It provides the audience with access to people and perspectives rarely heard in the U.S. corporate-sponsored media, including independent and international journalists, ordinary people from around the world who are directly affected by U.S. foreign policy, grassroots leaders and peace activists, artists, academics, and independent analysts. Another example is Peace Voice, a project of the Oregon Peace Institute. Peace Voice welcomes submission of op-eds that take a new story approach to international conflict and then distributes them to newspapers and blogs around the United States. Taking advantage of the internet, there are many blogs that also distribute the new paradigm thinking, including Waging Nonviolence, the Transcend Media Service, New Clear Vision, Peace Action Blog, Waging Peace Blog, Bloggers for Peace, and many other sites on the World Wide Web. With growing recognition of peace journalism, viable alternatives to the common destructive responses in the war system will be made available to the many publics. Once those alternatives come to light, it has been proven that there will be a decline in public support of war. Peace research, education, journalism, and blogging are part of the newly developing culture of peace, as are recent developments in religion. Utilize religion as a tool for peace building. Religion is a powerful force in human society, helping to define the virtuous life and how we should behave toward each other. But in the contemporary world, religious extremism often ignites violence. Just recently, we have seen an appeal to war by religious spokespersons. Christian coach Dave Dobermeyer said recently, "The only thing that is going to save Western civilization is a more aggressive, more violent Christianity." Similarly, Robert Jeffress, a religious advisor to U.S. President Trump, said just after meeting with him, "When it comes to how we should deal with evildoers, the Bible in the book of Romans is very clear. God has endowed rulers full power to use whatever means necessary, including war, to stop evil." In the case of North Korea, God has given Trump authority to take out Kim Jong-un. On the other side, a statement by a jihadi group said, "The ruling to kill Americans and their allies, civilians and military, is an individual duty for every Muslim who can do it in any country in which it is possible to do it, in order to liberate the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Holy Mosque in Mecca from their grip, and in order for their armies to move out of all the lands of Islam, defeated and unable to threaten any Muslim." These ideas only lead to relentless and vicious religious wars. Furthermore, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism all condone the concept of just war. In Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, the doctrine of just war is often used to explain why, in spite of teachings to the contrary, it is all right to make war. It goes like this: war is a sin, but in this sinful world, it is all right to make war if certain conditions are met. The list of preconditions for just war usually includes: a war can be declared only by a legitimate authority. A nation is the victim of aggression by others. All necessary means to solve the conflict peaceably have been exhausted. There must be a reasonable chance of success. The military means must be proportionate to the evil one is trying to defeat. Non-combatants must not be targeted, and the end of the war should restore a more just and peaceful relationship between the two parties than if the war had not been fought. This is vague language at best, and it is easy to twist these criteria to rationalize war making. For example, it is easy to falsely claim that the other side started the conflict, as Hitler did in attacking Poland in 1939. And in a more modern version, it is easy to claim that you are about to be attacked, or that the other side in the conflict is dangerously armed, and so a preemptive defense strike is necessary, as the U.S. did in attacking Iraq in 2003. Further, it is almost impossible to predict in advance that a war has a reasonable chance of success, or that the outcome will be better than the situation prior. Witness Libya after the NATO attack of 2011, which left the nation in chaos and civil war. Under just war theory, a bombing raid that kills thousands of civilians can be said to meet the criteria, if civilians were not the direct targets, but rather collateral damage. And in modern warfare, the overwhelming majority of victims are non-combatant civilians. And whether one intended it or not, they're just as dead and maimed as if one did. Honesty requires us to see just war theory as an excuse for murder. Just war doctrine has been around for some 1,600 years and has not helped to end war. Especially given the conditions of modern warfare, we need to argue that there is no way to satisfy the traditional criteria that just war doctrine has always had to meet. So, even if just war doctrine could somehow be compatible with the core ethical commandments of religion, it cannot be accomplished today or in the future. As World Beyond War co-founder and director David Swanson argues in War is Never Just, the traditional criteria are either impossible, amoral, or non-empirical and cannot be met. Even if they could be met in some future war, that war would also have to accomplish so much good as to outweigh all the death and suffering created by the diversion of resources into militarism, plus the risk of nuclear apocalypse created by the war system, plus the environmental and political damage created. No war, even in theory, can meet that standard. Therefore, it appears more reasonable for the faithful to figure out how to learn about and advocate for a process that ends war itself and replaces it with a peace system. If we cannot make war just, then the discussion turns away from trying to diminish war's horrific nature to abolition. Intemperate statements and just war rationalizations are distortions of the core ethical teachings of the major religions. All of the world's religions contain scriptural teachings that advocate peaceful relationships among all people. The golden rule is found in one form or another in them all, as in the scriptures below, as well as in the ethics of most atheists. For example, Christianity, whatever you wish that men would do to you, so do to them. Matthew 7:12. Judaism, what is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbor. Talmud, Shabbat 31a. Islam. Not one of you is a believer until he loves for his brother what he loves for himself. 40 Hadith of An-Nawawi 13. Hinduism. One should not behave toward others in a way which is disagreeable to oneself. This is the essence of morality. Mahabharata Anusana Parva 113.8. Buddhism. Comparing oneself to others in such terms is, just as I am, so are they. Just as they are, so am I. He should neither kill nor cause others to be killed. Sutta Nipata 705. African traditional. One going to take a pointed stick to pinch a baby bird should try first on himself to feel how it hurts. Yoruba proverb from Nigeria. Confucianism. Do not do to others what you do not want them to do to you. Enelex 15.23. Many religions host organizations for peace, such as the Episcopal Peace Fellowship, Pax Christi, the Jewish Voice for Peace, Muslims for Peace, the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, Yakja, a Hindu peace organization working in the Kashmir, and the Tenenbaum Center for Interreligious Understanding. Many interfaith peace organizations are also thriving, including the Fellowship of Reconciliation, established in 1915, United Religions Initiative, Religions for Peace USA, and Multifaith Voices for Peace and Justice. The World Council of Churches is heading up a campaign to abolish nuclear weapons. In his humane approach to world peace, the Buddhist spiritual leader Dalai Lama advocates loving kindness. In the build-up to military intervention in Syria, Pope Francis made a compelling appeal for seeking a peaceful resolution. During the 2011 Egyptian Revolution, Nevin Saki captured and tweeted the powerful image of Christians joining hands in a circle to protect a Muslim group of protesters as they prayed. In 2007, Muslim leaders reached out to Christians in an appeal for peace in their letter, A Common Word Between Us and You. in the spring of 2015, the Vatican hosted the conference Nonviolence and Just Peace, contributing to the Catholic understanding of and commitment to nonviolence. 80 participants concluded that the just war doctrine should be rejected as a viable or productive Catholic tradition. These are just a few snapshots of a larger trend of growing advocacy of peace messages in all major religions. Throughout the history of nonviolence, we have seen the importance of faith communities, recognizing that many nonviolent leaders are people of strong religious and moral faith. Just consider this simple quote by Catholic writer and peace activist Thomas Merton. War is the kingdom of Satan. Peace is the kingdom of God. Regardless of one's faith tradition, whether rejection of institutional religion, spiritual direction, or complete atheism, the work of peaceful religious initiatives is encouraging and should be further encouraged, if only as a matter of sensible pragmatism. The Declaration of Peace. These are self-evident truths, that all humans are a single family living on a fragile and endangered planet whose life support systems must remain intact if we are to survive. That the well-being of the planet and the well-being of humanity are one and the same. That the well-being of each requires the well-being of all. Security is common. That all humans have a natural right to peace and a healthy planet. That all war is a crime against humanity and nature. That any war, anywhere, degrades the quality of life for all of us, everywhere. That we live at the decisive moment in history when we will choose between breakdown or breakthrough on a planetary scale. That we here now dedicate our intellectual, spiritual, and material resources to the establishment of permanent peace and the conservation of nature. And that we are fully endowed by our Creator with the wisdom and the ability to achieve these ends. Chapter 7. Accelerating the Transition, Building the World Beyond War Movement. What we have outlined as the alternative global security system is more than a concept. It lays out the foundation for World Beyond War, a global grassroots network of volunteers, activists, and allied organizations advocating for war abolition and the establishment of a just and sustainable peace. We follow a two-pronged approach of peace education and nonviolent direct action, organizing to dispel the myths of war, educate about its alternatives, and advocate for structural and cultural change. The strength of our movement depends on having a diversity of support from people all over the world coming together for a singular cause, peace. To that end, over 500 organizations and 75,000 individuals from 175 countries have signed our Declaration of Peace, pledging to work nonviolently for a world beyond war. Our decentralized, volunteer-run structure, consisting of World Beyond War chapters and affiliated groups around the world, is designed to facilitate global collaboration and bottom-up decision-making. The World Beyond War Declaration of Peace. I understand that wars and militarism make us less safe rather than protect us, that they kill, injure, and traumatize adults, children, and infants, severely damage the natural environment, erode civil liberties, and drain our economies, siphoning resources from life-affirming activities. I commit to engage in and support nonviolent efforts to end all war and preparations for war, and to create a sustainable and just peace. In building a movement for war abolition, our work addresses the entire institution of war, setting us apart from past models that opposed only specific weapons or a particular war on the grounds that it isn't being run well or it isn't as proper as some other war. Through our education programs and advocacy campaigns, we shift the moral dialogue by making the case that the institution of war should be viewed as tantamount to mass murder, even when that mass murder is accompanied by flags or music or assertions of authority and promotion of irrational fear. We expand the focus of peace activism beyond the harm that wars cause to the aggressors in order to fully acknowledge and appreciate the suffering of all. In working towards global war abolition, the elephant in the room is the United States government, which at $1 trillion U.S. dollars a year accounts for half of global annual military spending. Because of the proliferation of U.S.-led wars and the global spread of U.S. foreign military bases, our work squarely acknowledges the U.S.'s primary role as global warmonger and aims to engage citizens everywhere, not just U.S. residents, in a campaign to demilitarize the world's largest war machine. While ending U.S. warmaking wouldn't eliminate war globally, it would eliminate the pressure that is driving several other nations to increase their military spending. It would deprive NATO of its leading advocate for and against participants in wars. It would cut off the largest supply of weapons to the Middle East and other regions. It would remove the major barrier to reconciliation and reunification of Korea. It would create U.S. willingness to support arms treaties, join the International Criminal Court, and allow the United Nations to move in the direction of its stated purpose of eliminating war. It would create a world free of nations threatening first use of nukes, and a world in which nuclear disarmament might proceed more rapidly. Gone would be the last major nation using cluster bombs or refusing to ban landmines. If the United States kicked the war habit, war itself would suffer a major and possibly fatal setback. A focus on U.S. war preparations cannot work in isolation without similar efforts everywhere. Numerous nations are investing and even increasing their investments in war. All militarism must be opposed, and victories for a peace system tend to spread by example. When the British Parliament opposed attacking Syria in 2013, it influenced the U.S. to follow suit and nix its proposal for war. In January 2014 in Havana, Cuba, when 31 nations committed to never making use of war, those voices were heard in other nations of the world. Coalition building. Our holistic approach prioritizes multilateral coalition building, or fusion organizing. This involves building cross-sector collaborations with those that ought to oppose the military-industrial complex due to its widespread social and ecological impact. Environmentalists, the faith community, ethicists, public health advocates, mental health professionals, economists, journalists, historians, labor unions, civil libertarians, internationalists, world travelers, and good government groups. Additionally, there are opportunities for partnership with proponents of measures that could be funded if war dollars were reallocated, such as advocates for education, health care, housing, arts, science, and infrastructure reform. This broad-based coalition work aims to overcome a common issue in activist circles of working in single-issue silos. The Alternative Global Security System, AGSS, offers a unifying language wherein different social movement organizations can align without losing their organizational or movement identity. Multi-track diplomacy is a systems-based approach to peace-building developed and put into practice by Louise Diamond and former Ambassador John W. McDonald. Multi-track diplomacy reflects the idea that international exchanges can take many forms beyond official negotiations between diplomats. Examples of multi-track diplomacy include official and unofficial conflict resolution efforts, citizen and scientific exchanges, international business negotiations, international cultural and athletic activities, and other international contacts and cooperative efforts. 9 specific tracks which provide a synergy in peacebuilding are public opinion and communication, government, professional conflict resolution, business, private citizens, activism, religion, funding, and research, training, and education. The appealing factor in such a system is that all actors have a role to play in advancing peace. This allows for them to individually and collectively bring their strengths into a larger system, empowering the whole. It comes down to the simple idea that not everyone can be all things to all people, but that everyone has a role to play. Peace education programs. Peace education is one prong of our two-step approach to change-making. Education is a critical component of an alternative global security system and an essential tool for getting us there. Our programs educate both about and for the abolition of war. Our educational resources are based on knowledge and research that expose the myths of war and illuminate the proven, nonviolent, peaceful alternatives that can bring us authentic security. We encourage participants in our programs to reflect upon critical questions and engage in dialogue with peers toward challenging assumptions of the war system. These forms of critical, reflective learning have been well documented to support increased political efficacy and action for system change. World Beyond War offers numerous tools and resources for engaged learning, in addition to this annual publication, which is available in print, ebook, PDF, and audio formats. Our educational resources are designed to be distributed widely to popularize support for war abolition. To that end, we work with volunteers in our network worldwide to organize World Beyond War book clubs, discussion groups, film series, and guest lectures. Our website, worldbeyondwar.org, serves as a free information hub for the war abolition movement. It houses militarism maps, charts, graphics, arguments, talking points, articles, and videos to help people make the case that wars can, should, and must be abolished. Each section of the website includes lists of relevant books and films and links to external resources. We also offer online courses, a free educational webinar series, a speakers bureau, and Study War No More, a free online study and discussion guide that accompanies this book. Bolstering our educational efforts is our Global Billboard Project. Funded primarily by small-dollar donors, our roadside billboards, bus shelter posters, and subway advertisements amplify the war abolition message in the public eye. Study War No More is an online learning tool developed in partnership with the Global Campaign for Peace Education. The guide can be used for independent study or as a tool for facilitating dialogue and discussion in classrooms and with community groups. Each discussion topic features a video introduction from our study and action partners, leading global thinkers, strategists, academics, advocates, and activists who are already developing components of an alternative global security system. The guide can be accessed at globalsecurity.worldbeyondwar.org. Online courses. World Beyond War offers facilitated online courses led by experts and allied activists and changemakers from around the world. Past offerings have included War Abolition 101, How We Create a Peaceful World. How can we make the best argument for shifting from war to peace? How can we become more effective advocates and activists for ending particular wars, ending all wars, pursuing disarmament, and creating systems that maintain peace? War Abolition 201, Building the Alternative Global Security System. With what do we replace the war system? That is, the military-industrial corporate governmental complex. What truly makes us secure? What are the moral, social, political, philosophical, and pragmatic foundations of an alternative global security system? A system in which peace is pursued by peaceful means. What actions and strategies might we pursue in building this system? War Abolition 201 explores these questions and more with the goal of engaging students in learning that leads to action. The aim of our education programs is to shift the narrative about war so that the talk of a good war will sound no more plausible than a benevolent rape, or philanthropic slavery, or virtuous child abuse. Our education programs foster a culture of peace in which war resistors, conscientious objectors, peace advocates, diplomats, whistleblowers, journalists, nonviolent activists, and human shields are society's true heroes. Our materials use common language and appeal to shared values that make the alternative global security system palatable to the public at large. At the same time, we move beyond mainstream Western peace symbolism, such as the peace sign, doves, oil branches, and people holding hands. These cliché symbols, while non-contentious, fail to communicate tangible means of peace. Rather, the AGSS offers a new vocabulary and vision of realistic alternatives to war and paths toward common security. We use the framework of world citizenship to advance popular thinking beyond patriotism, nationalism, xenophobia, racism, religious bigotry, and exceptionalism. In this way, the alternative global security system is cross-cultural and transnational. Global solidarity in educational efforts constitutes an important part of the education itself. Student and cultural exchanges between the West and nations on the Pentagon's likely target list, Syria, Iran, North Korea, China, and Russia, can foster peace-building and strengthen people's resistance towards their governments waging wars. Similar exchanges between nations investing in war and nations that have ceased to do so, or which do so at a greatly reduced scale, can be of great value as well. In the film The Ultimate Wish, Ending the Nuclear Age, we see a survivor of Nagasaki meeting a survivor of Auschwitz. In watching their interaction, one does not remember or care which nation committed the horror. A peace culture will see all war with that same clarity. War is an abomination, not because of who commits it, but because of what it is. Nonviolent Direct Action Campaigns. Our strategic war abolition campaign is broken down into short-term and intermediate advocacy goals, understood as partial steps along the way towards replacing the war system. These goals are accomplished through nonviolent direct action organizing campaigns, which include weapons divestment, counter-recruitment, close bases, and global justice. These campaigns operate in tandem to our peace education programs, serving both as tools for policy change and continued education and awareness building. As a hub for educational campaign materials, organizing training, and promotional assistance, World Beyond War teams up with activists, volunteers, and allied groups to plan, promote, and amplify pro-peace campaigns worldwide. Weapons divestment. World Beyond War is a founding member of the Divest from the War Coalition. Through grassroots campaigns worldwide, the coalition works to divest individual, institutional, and government funds from weapons manufacturing corporations and military contractors, and advocates for socially responsible reinvestment alternatives. Counter-recruitment. This campaign counters military recruiting in schools by advocating for increased transparency and expanded avenues for opting out of recruitment. Designed for the U.S., the campaign can be scaled up and tailored to counter country-specific recruitment. In the U.S., campaign goals include passing state-level opt-out legislation to better inform parents of their legal right to opt their children out of recruitment and shutting down JROTC marksmanship programs in high schools. As of 2018, Maryland was the only U.S. state with strong opt-out legislation on the books. Close bases. This campaign aims to raise public awareness and organize nonviolent mass resistance against military bases around the world, with particular emphasis on U.S. foreign military bases, which constitute 95% of all foreign military bases worldwide. Foreign military bases are centers of warmongering and expansionism, causing severe environmental, economic, political, and health impacts on local populations. World Beyond War is a founding member in the Coalition Against U.S. Foreign Military Bases. Global Justice and the Rule of Law. This policy-centered campaign petitions governments to abide by international law. It calls for the ratification of the amendment to the Rome Statute on the prosecution of the crime of aggression, compulsory jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice, and the prosecution of all war crimes at the International Criminal Court. Pass resolutions. A tactic in our war abolition campaign is to pass local and state or provincial level resolutions calling for the reallocation of military spending to human and environmental needs. Together with our allies, we have helped pass resolutions in numerous localities to demand a decrease in government spending on war and preparations for war. Direct action organizing involves building our strength in numbers and then utilizing that people power en masse to put targeted pressure on decision makers such as elected officials, institutional heads, or corporate executives to urge them to make the policy changes that we want to see. To this end, organizing requires constant outreach to individuals and allied organizations to take collective action. Each campaign area employs varied tactics, offering activists numerous avenues for engagement. Campaign tactics include, but are not limited to, collecting petition signatures, phone banking, organizational and elected official sign-on letters, writing letters to the editor and op-eds, social media campaigning, meeting with elected officials and other decision makers, and organizing nonviolent, Gandhian-style protests, sit-ins, and marches. Tactics can vary in type and intensity in accordance with the strategy needed to sway a decision maker to achieve the campaign's goal. Organizations like Campaign Nonviolence and the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict examine the use of nonviolent direct action and conflict escalation worldwide and create trainings for activists and organizers based on insights from practice and research. Conclusion. War is always a choice, and it is always a bad choice. It is a choice that always leads to more war. It is not mandated in our genes or our human nature. It is not the only possible response to conflicts. Nonviolent action is a more effective choice because it defuses and helps resolve conflict. But the choice for nonviolence must not wait until conflict erupts. It must be built into society. built into institutions for conflict forecasting, mediation, adjudication, and peacekeeping. It must be built into education in the form of knowledge, perceptions, beliefs, and values. In short, a culture of peace. Societies consciously prepare far in advance for the war response, and so perpetuate insecurity. Why would humans continue on this path? Even pre-conflict prevention is more effective and less costly than post-conflict conflict protection. In other words, preventing war is less costly than cleaning up after war. And that does not even include the human suffering and trauma that can be avoided. Some powerful groups benefit from war and violence. The vast majority of humans, however, will gain a lot from a world beyond war. For peace to prevail, we must prepare far in advance for the better choice. If you want peace, prepare for peace. Environmentalist and author Paul Hawken wrote, "Forget that this task of planet saving is not possible in the time required. Don't be put off by people who know what is not possible. Do what needs to be done, and check to see if it was impossible only after you are done." Here are a few points for inspiration. In less than 4 years, over 75,000 people and 500 organizations from 175 countries have signed World Beyond War's Pledge for Peace. Demilitarization is underway. Costa Rica and 24 other countries have disbanded their militaries altogether. European nations, which have fought each other for over 1,000 years, including the horrendous world wars of the 20th century, now work collaboratively in the European Union. Former advocates of nuclear weapons, including former U.S. senators and secretaries of state, and numerous retired high-ranking military officers, have publicly rejected nuclear weapons and called for their abolition. There is a massive worldwide movement to end the carbon economy and hence the wars over oil. Many thoughtful people and organizations around the world are calling for an end to the counterproductive war on terror. Over 1 million organizations in the world are actively working toward peace, social justice, and environmental protection. 31 Latin American and Caribbean nations created a zone of peace on January 29, 2014. In the last 100 years, we humans have created, for the first time in history, institutions and movements to control international violence. The UN, the World Court, the International Criminal Court, and treaties such as the Kellogg-Briand Pact, the Treaty to Ban Landmines, the Treaty to Ban Child Soldiers, and many more. In 2017, the Treaty on the Prohibition on Nuclear Weapons was adopted by the United Nations. A peace revolution is already underway. Addenda, Feminist Foreign Policy. At the nation-state policy level, we are witnessing the development of a series of very promising frameworks, which broadly can be described as Feminist Foreign Policies, or FFPs. Here is how the Center for Feminist Foreign Policy defines these frameworks. A feminist foreign policy is a framework which elevates the everyday lived experience of marginalized communities to the forefront and provides a broader and deeper analysis of global issues. It takes a step outside the black box approach of traditional foreign policy thinking and its focus on military force, violence, and domination by offering an alternative and intersectional rethinking of security from the viewpoint of the most marginalized. It is a multidimensional policy framework that aims to elevate women's and marginalized groups' experiences and agency to scrutinize the destructive forces of patriarchy, capitalism, racism, and militarism. As we can see, a feminist foreign policy is a response to a patriarchal and violent foreign policy status quo. It is a solution that rebalances power inequalities and provides a political framework informed by people who face the consequences of policy decisions. According to the International Center for Research on Women, feminist foreign policy is one tool that shows promise for taking a much-needed intersectional and often multilateral approach to women's rights, simultaneously addressing urgent issues such as climate change, peace and security, inclusive growth, global health, and poverty alleviation. FFPs are policy approaches that place gender analysis at the center of national security concerns. They question dominant cultural ideas of what is considered masculine and how they are built into national security paradigms. Carol Cohen, a leading voice on gender and security, reminds us that many of our assumptions and beliefs about which security policies will be effective arise from a series of gendered ideas about how to most effectively exercise power, what it means to be strong, and what works to keep us secure. A feminist foreign policy is the antidote. It demilitarizes security not only conceptually, but through direct changes, priorities, and practices to conventional policies that have been traditionally grounded in a militarized security paradigm. In talking about nuclear policy, Marissa Conway, co-founder of the Center for Feminist Foreign Policy, reminds us that the human experience must be at the center and that every policy option must be explored through a diversity of perspectives based on true security, not a drive for power and money. There are several countries, led initially by Sweden in 2014, that have adopted or are now pursuing their respective feminist foreign policies. In May of 2020, more than 50 U.S. organizations launched a call for a feminist foreign policy in the United States. Key considerations in any feminist foreign policy should be the inclusion of marginalized voices, intersectional analysis, the rethinking of security, and shifting spending priorities. Feminist foreign policies, while grounded in feminist scholarship, already are a reality. With advocacy and growing recognition, these frameworks can create new norms in foreign policy, moving a national security discourse away from a militaristic paradigm. Infrastructures for peace. In a remarkable gap in global peace building, few countries in the world have national infrastructures for peace, or I4Ps. Virtually all have departments of defense, formerly departments of war, as well as some variation of departments of security built upon a paramilitary policy and structure. The military infrastructure is highly resourced, easily mobilized, and present at all levels in a given society. In the structural system, it is no wonder that, in policy and decision-making at the cabinet level, decisions are most often based upon a military-type intervention. Even responses to environmental and climate issues have become largely scrutinized in this policy environment. What is needed is a parallel peace-building structure that counteracts this tendency, where a minister or a secretary of peace is mandated to view all matters of peace and security through the lens of nonviolence and peace by peaceful means. Further, this approach needs to be bottom-up, so that, supported by the state, people in their communities become the heart of their own collective peace and security through novel peace-building structures at the local and regional levels. This represents a truly alternative security system. John Paul Lederach introduced the concept of I4P in his book, Building Peace, Sustainable Reconciliation in Divided Societies. He writes, "Building peace in today's conflicts calls for long-term commitment to establishing an infrastructure across the levels of society, an infrastructure that empowers the resources of reconciliation from within that society and maximizes the contribution from outside." Here is a general definition developed by the United Nations Development Program, UNDP, in concert with the African Union. An I4P is a network of interdependent systems, resources, values, and skills held by the government, civil society, and community institutions that promote dialogue and consultation, prevent conflict, and enable peaceful mediation when violence occurs in a society. The Global Alliance for Ministries and Infrastructures for Peace, GAMIP, was formed in 2005 and has held biannual global summits to pursue this work. The core concept is to institutionalize peacebuilding to counter the institutionalization of war. Its members on the ground were instrumental in the creation of both the Costa Rican and Nepalese ministries mentioned below. There have been several developments in the formation of national ministries or departments of peace: Solomon Islands, Nepal, Autonomous Region of Bougainville, and Ethiopia are all examples of post-conflict developments. The Nepal ministry has been terminated, while the others are all continuing to develop. Afghanistan has also created a state ministry of peace, preoccupied with negotiations with the Taliban in that ongoing conflict. Aloya Hirga was convened in 2019, a peace assembly bringing together tribal elders throughout Afghan society to consider peace and security issues. Costa Rica created the Vice Minister for Peace as part of the Ministry of Justice and Peace. This is the only example of a minister position being formed as a result of a consistent policy of peacemaking that began in 1948 with the abolition of its army, followed by its declaration of neutrality in 1983. Although GAMIP's focus originally was on such departments at the national level, it realized that the broader concept of I4P embraced a much wider field. While a national-level department is essential for overall coordination, at the same time, peace-building structures are also needed at the regional and local levels. Conflicts need to be resolved at the level at which they occur, typically engaging local peace committees made up of respected local leaders and often utilizing traditional and culturally appropriate models of peace-building. State-level representatives may or may not be present, but generally do not determine how negotiations are structured. This article will only include examples of I4P that are active at all levels within a country, since incidental and isolated examples, although perhaps outstanding, are inadequate to meet the needs of external and internal peace and security. The history of most peace processes is that they are often established piecemeal and then terminated following a successful negotiation, even though the success may be short-lived, often top-down, and not widely supported. Kenya created the National Policy on Peacebuilding and Conflict Management in December 2011. This followed pre- and post-electoral and ethnic violence. The policy has six key pillars that are critical to the achievement of its overall goals. It underscores the need for conflict-sensitive planning and programming at all levels of regional, sub-regional, national, and community development. These pillars are institutional framework, capacity building, conflict prevention, mediation and preventive diplomacy, traditional conflict prevention and mitigation, and post-conflict recovery and stabilization. District peace councils have been established in most districts, along with elders' councils, promoting traditional ways of resolving conflict. Emphasis has been given to improving early warning and response systems and building capability for peace building among all stakeholders, assisted by the state with the increased participation of women. Ghana created the National Peace Council, NPC, through the National Peace Council Act of 2011. The NPC is funded by, but kept at arm's length from, the national government. Its membership, all of whom are volunteers, include members with political, ethnic, and religious affiliations. Under the NPC are the Council Secretariat, the County Peace Secretariat in each region, and District Peace Committees. The NPC coordinates and networks with the other levels, provides training in conflict prevention and resolution, and funding for various level peace forums to meet. Depending on the nature of the issue or conflict, the relevant level of organization is involved. Kyrgyzstan sees I4Ps as part of a sustainable development strategy to strengthen the unity of the people and inter-ethnic relations through various structures. Among these are the Department of Ethnic Religious Policy and Cooperation with Civil Society and the State Agency on Local Self-Government and Inter-Ethnic Relations within the national government, created in 2013. The cooperation of these structures with civil society through regional consultative peace committees was pivotal. The achievements of this approach include a significant reduction in inter-ethnic violence in succeeding years, as the country has worked to establish an inclusive society where all citizens feel part of the state and perceive and take ownership of peace processes. Like the other cases above, this is a work in progress. The United Nations is the site of a movement building since the GAMEP Canada Summit in 2006 and spearheaded by Peace Now and GAMEP members to present a resolution to the UN General Assembly through member states calling for the creation of I4P in all governments. I4P may constitute entities and processes at various levels of formality, formal, non-formal, and semi-formal, and may accordingly encompass national, subnational, and local community levels. They can be established through top-down or bottom-up processes or a mix of both. I4P may be formal national institutions, such as peace ministries, which are ideally connected to local mechanisms for dealing with conflict, such as local peace committees or LPCs. Paul Van Tongeren outlines some best practices in the development of LPCs. 1. LPCs work best when there is a national I4P organized at all levels within a state, but function with a high level of local autonomy from the national or regional government. 2. Generally, peace processes begin from the bottom up and must allow for local innovation in terms of structure and organization and engage participants recognized in the community who are often traditional leaders within the socio-cultural context. 3. Government representatives may be present, acting primarily as liaisons to upper levels rather than steering the local process, and provide financial support and training. 4. LPCs can often function where government cannot or is regarded with suspicion and may be able to defuse potentially volatile situations, as in the case of pre- and post-electoral or ethnic tensions. 5. There are no standard formulas that can be used in all contexts, but should emerge from the specific local conditions. 6. All parties to a conflict and all those impacted must be represented with, ideally, equal representation of women and men. The role of youth in peace and security. The role of young people in peace and security is both a moral and pragmatic imperative. It is a moral imperative because the need for young people to be involved in the policies and programs that affect their lives is a basic human right, according to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. In September 1999, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, stated, "Youth are the present. Their involvement is necessary for human development and sustainability. The strongest demand expressed today by the youth themselves is that of participation. Peace and security processes, therefore, should provide opportunities for young people to be included in all stages of the program cycle, so that the work is grounded in their needs and that it aligns with broader human rights. Youth inclusion in peace and security work is a pragmatic imperative because today's young generation is the largest, fastest-growing demographic in history. Globally, there are 1.8 billion youth between the ages of 10 and 24, or more than one out of every four people on the planet. It is projected that the number of people aged 15 to 24 could reach up to 40% by the year 2030. Of the estimated 3.1 billion youth and children under the age of 25, the majority, nearly 2.7 billion, are currently living in rapidly growing cities of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. If we are able to make the goal of ending war a bit more attainable, then we must equip the world's unprecedented youth population with the tools, resources, and support needed to prevent violence and sustain peace. Young people are often at the forefront of peace and security issues, both through their positive contributions and through their frustration of being routinely excluded from such issues. Acknowledging gaps that exist in youth-led peacebuilding, described below, there are a growing number of young people working to advance the prospects of peace and security at the local, national, regional, and global levels. There are also many organizations and initiatives working to strengthen youth participation in peacebuilding policy and practice. Prominent examples include the Global Coalition on Youth, Peace and Security, Search for Common Ground, the United Network of Young Peacebuilders, the United Nations Major Group for Children and Youth, Alliance for Peacebuilding, Peace Direct, Generations for Peace, Peace Jam, Youth for Peace International, the Peace Education Network, the Quakers, New Gen Peacebuilders, War Child, Seeds of Peace, Young Peacebuilders, the Commonwealth Youth Peace Ambassadors Network, KCID, Friends Committee National Legislation, and Friends on Preventing Violent Extremism, among others. An increasing number of academics, practitioners, and policymakers also argue that the inclusive and meaningful participation of young people in peace processes is a prerequisite for achieving the UN's Sustaining Peace Agenda and the Sustainable Development Goals more broadly. This includes UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who maintains that the world needs youth to keep speaking out, applying pressure, and pushing boundaries to have us protect our planet and improve the lives of people. Spiritual leaders, too, have been strong proponents of the link between youth and peace. Gandhi, for example, argued that if we are to reach real peace in this world, and if we are to carry on a real war against war, we shall have to begin with children. There are three main ways of looking at the role of youth in peace and security. First, youth as victims, which looks at how young people are affected by war and violence. There is evidence that young people have been disproportionately affected by armed conflict. Today, over 600 million young people live in fragile and conflict-affected settings. Second, youth as perpetrators, which looks at the way in which young people, and particularly young men, are viewed as a threat to peace and security. In this context, much has been written about the so-called youth bulge, which refers to the role that large cohorts of youth may play in increasing the risk of violence and insecurity. While such claims are not uncontested, it has been observed that the overwhelming majority of people who become violent extremists are males, between the ages of 16 and 30. Third, youth as peace builders, which refers to young people's agency, resilience, and positive contributions to peace and security. This discourse focuses on young people as key actors in transforming violent conflict and in promoting and maintaining international and domestic peace and security. Of the three above-mentioned roles, there has been a strong tendency amongst policymakers, practitioners, and academics to pay more attention to the role of young people as victims or perpetrators of violence rather than peace builders. This focus tends to be gendered, too, with young women being viewed as victims and young men as perpetrators. One of the consequences of this is that the role of young people in transforming conflict and fostering a culture of peace remains an underdeveloped area of study and practice. This missing focus on youth-led peacebuilding and the urgency and benefits of filling this gap has not gone unnoticed by the global community. In the last 5 years, numerous developments have made an impact on what is being referred to as the Youth Peace and Security, YPS, agenda. Most notably, the UN Security Council Resolution 2250 on Youth Peace and Security was unanimously adopted in 2015 as UNSCR 2250. Driven by youth activism, this is the first resolution fully dedicated to the important and positive role young people play in the maintenance and promotion of peace and security. The resolution identifies 5 pillars for action to facilitate young people's contribution to peace processes and conflict resolution: participation, partnerships, prevention, protection, and disengagement and reintegration. Since the adoption of UNSCR 2250, several other developments have taken place. These include the adoption of UN Security Council Resolution 2419, which calls on countries to include youth in the negotiation and implementation of peace agreements, the UN Strategy on Youth, Youth 2030, which identifies peace and security as one of the UN's core priorities in relation to the work that the UN does with and for youth worldwide, the Youth Peace and Security Act, which was introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives in 2020 to create a policy to strengthen U.S. support of young peacebuilders overseas, and the creation of a Youth Peace, Security, and Prosperity Fund, and the adoption of UN Security Council Resolution 2535, which calls for protection of youth in civic spaces, recognizes the agency of youth in humanitarian response, and establishes a 2-year reporting mechanism on YPS. There has also been an increase in the number of organizations, programs, and publications focusing on the role and impact of young people in peace and security work, and global networks, working groups, toolkits, and funding streams are also expanding. Still, while the global community is beginning to shift the narrative from youth as victims or perpetrators of violence to youth as peace builders, we are still not doing enough to harness the power of youth as agents of peace. A powerful example of this dynamic was found in the UN Security Council mandated study that sought to evaluate youth's positive contribution to peace processes in conflict resolution. The analysis and recommendations were based on 7 regional youth consultations, direct consultation with more than 4,000 young people, over 280 focus groups in 44 countries, 45 thematic and country-specific studies, and a global survey of youth-led peacebuilding organizations. The study's participatory approach can act as a model for engaging youth in future peace and security efforts. The general tenor of this study revealed that while young people are contributing to a culture of peace in various ways, they are too often underrepresented in peace processes. According to the study, young people describe their experience of exclusion manifesting in six core areas: political, economic, education, gender, injustice and human rights, and disengagement and reintegration. This exclusion experience can be traced back to a growing intergenerational trust gap between young people and their governments, the multilateral system, and the delivery of democracy itself. The study also found that there is a strong tendency to associate young people with violence. This is problematic because it constrains the agency of young people as peace actors and gives rise to negative stereotypes, which disproportionately shape policies and programmatic work toward hard security approaches. As an example, the United States spent $2.8 trillion U.S. dollars on what it called counterterrorism between 2002 and 2017. A significant proportion of this went toward tackling youth extremism, which, by and large, targets a relatively small number of young people who are considered to be at risk or a problem. An over-reliance on investing in such programs can compromise funding for other efforts targeting larger numbers of young people who have the potential to play leadership roles in advancing sustainable peace and resilience. Against this background, it should be noted that most young people do not turn to violence to solve their problems. On the contrary, the overwhelming majority of young people worldwide are peaceful. Alongside the gaps identified by this study are a set of recommendations. These can be summed up in three concepts: investment, inclusion, and partnership. While investment in funding for peace and security work with young people has increased in recent years, insufficient funding to meet the need endures. The study, therefore, proposes to allocate $1.8 billion U.S. dollars to the YPS agenda, representing an investment of one U.S. dollar per young person globally by 2025 for the 10th anniversary of UNSCR 2250. Besides targeting young people considered to be at risk or a problem, as is done currently, much more can be done to also target young people who are not involved in violence. This includes early intervention models to support young people's capacities, agency, and leadership for peace. Inclusion does not just mean incorporating youth voices. It also means young people playing a key role in the design, delivery, and evaluation of their own peace-building activities and strategies. This means sharing power with the same young people who are frequently the objects of peace and security policy and practice. Peace processes that are designed with and led by youth move young people from being passive recipients of policy and programmatic efforts to active subjects of positive action. Partnership is about bringing young people, youth movements, and youth-led organizations together to effectively realize the YPS agenda locally, nationally, regionally, and globally. A major challenge facing the global community is how to translate policy into practice. This includes moving the YPS agenda beyond the Security Council to member states and local communities, acknowledging that all work must be implemented in a conflict-sensitive manner. In response to this challenge, a series of promising regional frameworks, policy guidelines, and national action plans continue to be created. At the same time, it is clear that we find ourselves at the beginning of a long journey, and much more can be done to mainstream young people's meaningful and inclusive participation in building more peaceful, cohesive, and resilient societies. This dynamic is exemplified in the first UN report on the YPS agenda since UNSCR 2250 was adopted. In creating a world beyond war, a more transformative and more empowering approach to peace and security work with young people needs to be adopted. The following processes are required. 1. Investing sufficient money, time, and energy so that young people can access the skills, tools, and resources necessary to realize their power and potential as peace builders. 2. Putting young people at the center of peace building and security decision making, planning, and action at all levels. And 3. Building partnerships between young people, multilateral, governmental, and civil society actors to make the vision of the YPS agenda a reality. This has been A Global Security System, An Alternative to War, the 5th edition, originally written by Kent Shifford, Patrick Hiller, and David Swanson, edited by Tony Jenkins and Phil Gittins, and narrated by Tim Pluta. Copyright 2020 by World Beyond War. Production copyright 2020 by Tutu Estudios in Asturias, Spain. Special thanks to Sergio Rodriguez and Sergio Diaz.